This is Dr. Richard Barone. I'm conducting an oral history interview with Ms. Diana Curry. Today is August 8, 2005. It's 1:45 p.m. Central Standard Time. And Diana and I are in the Special Collections Library Vietnam Archive interview room on the campus of Texas Tech University in Lubbock, Texas. Diana, let's start with a couple of basic biographical questions. First, if you could, tell me a little bit about where you were born, when you were born, and about growing up. Before you go there, let me remind myself to ask you, we are recording this for the Vietnam Archive Oral History Project. This interview will be donated to the Vietnam Archive as one of a collection of yours, and also will be available on the internet, published on the internet, basically, by the Vietnam Archive. And do you agree to be interviewed, and do you agree to that that publishing and donation?
Yes, I do agree.
Okay, very good. Now, where were you born, and when were you born?
I was born in Detroit, Michigan, September 30th, 1948.
Okay. Did you grow up there in Detroit?
No, I did not. My father joined the Air Force before I was even a year old. And we were promptly stationed to, well, at Selfridge Air Force Base there in Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
And then I can't remember exactly where we went after that, but when I was about four, we were stationed in Japan.
Wow.
And he was involved in the crash boats there, picking up downed pilots and stuff during, well, the Korean War.
Which right.
Still,
right.
Yeah. Then we came back, and we were stationed in Eglin Air Force Base, Florida, for 3 years. And then we went to France. I'm going to try to make sure I have this all in order.
Right.
In 1957, we went to France for 2 years. And then in 1959, mm-hmm. When all the military was... had to exit
mm-hmm.
France. We went to Germany on Air Force Base
mm-hmm.
for 2 years. Then we came back. We were stationed at Williams Air Force Base in Arizona for 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
And then we went to Randolph Air Force Base for 3 years. And then I graduated from high school there at Randolph High School.
And I know that's where you met Pat there
yes.
at Randolph.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. That's quite a lot of moving for a young lady in the 50s and into the 60s. Your dad was career Air Force.
Yes.
He stayed in?
Yes.
Okay. And tell me, what memories do you have of Japan? Do you remember that?
I have funny memories because I was only five.
Okay.
And from pictures and stuff like that, I remember, I don't know if you want to hear some of this.
Sure.
I have a sister that's 17 months younger than I am, so we're very close
uh-huh.
and getting in trouble and everything. And one of the things I remember is that we babysat a monkey one time. That some people had a monkey and we had to babysit it.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a maid called Sumiko.
Mm-hmm.
And she made popcorn for us one time. And we said, well, aren't you going to put butter on the popcorn? So she just put a piece of butter, put on the popcorn. We said, no, that's not right. Because we're just tiny, you know.
Yeah.
So, oh, and we played on the stairs. That was the first time I tried to shave my face like my dad. I was scarred to prove it. And I remember doing that, but that's about it.
How you were there? What, age five?
I was there at 5 years old and
sure.
to turn to six. Yeah,
okay.
Between four and five.
Okay.
We were only there a year.
Okay.
And I do remember on the military side of it, my dad, because of what he did, was gone for like a month or two at a time. And we had to go through, this was in, 53 or 54, I can't remember. And I remember going through the drills of, I forget even what it's called now, of us having to exit. And my mom had a suitcase with everything in it to get through 3 or 4 days until we could get on
kind of
the bus.
Evacuating.
Evacuation, yes.
Okay.
And when I was married to Pat, we did the same thing. The communists weren't really too bad back then. It was mostly the Korean stuff, because the Soviets were still kind of, it wasn't too bad yet. That really started in the late 50s and into the 60s when I was a kid.
Yeah.
But it was mostly the Koreans, the North Koreans,
right.
That was our threat at that time.
Right. And you're living just across the
right.
ocean.
Right.
Just across the sea.
And most of the Air Force were, they didn't have, from what I understand, the Air Force didn't have helicopters yet. They were still going into having helicopters. Most of the helicopters still, even today, I believe, are still with the Army and the Marines and stuff. But they didn't have this crash boat thing. They've done a big thing on that too, because it was an individualized unit, and it only existed for about a year because the helicopters did start coming in and start taking over their job. Anyway, it was called the crash boats, and it was a unit of the Air Force.
Okay.
And my dad had some previous Navy experience, and so that's why he was. It was like a PT boat.
Right.
And so he was gone for a long time.
Did he join the Air Force, you said, in right when you were born, or was he in World War II?
My dad was quite a character. Let's put it that way.
That's a good answer.
He was an only child. His dad died when he was young, and he lived with his mom. They didn't get along very well, so he ran away. To make a long story short, he tried to, because they lived in Michigan, he was too young to join the military here during World War II. So he went to Canada and lied about his age, and almost got his pilot's wings to fly, because that's what he really wanted to do. They found out about it, sent him back. By then he was old enough to join the Navy, so that's what he did. So he was in the Navy during World War II for a short period of time.
Wow, what did he do?
I really don't know. But he said he was on Iwo Jima.
Okay.
So, but that's all I remember.
Okay. All right. Tell me, before we talk a little bit more about your dad and his military service and where you went, you mentioned a younger sister.
Yes, I have two sisters.
Two sisters. Okay.
My sister Patty, she's 17 months younger than I am, and then my sister Jeannie is 6 years younger than me.
Okay. So you were the oldest, are the oldest.
I am, yes.
Okay. Tell me about your mother.
My mom was raised on a farm. And my mom and dad met. They were both working in the same department store in Mount Clemens. I think it was Mount Clemens, Michigan. And that's where they met.
Okay.
And she was glad to get out of the farming and stuff like that. It was a hard life. And she was very excited, but my dad went out and joined the military without telling her, and, well, he just wanted, the money situation was not too good, and so that was one way that they could, and he loved to travel, wanted to get out, they both really did want to get out of the thing, so she was fine, she did everything, did the travel, I learned everything that kept me strong from my mom. She went through harder times than I did. My dad was never really stationed overseas without her for length of time like Pat was. But he was deployed for like a couple months at a time. And she was independent when he was gone. And back in those days, in the 40s and the 60s, 50s, the woman was supposed to be the not the dominant, but the
subordinate.
The subordinate.
And the kind of
so she was dominant when she was supposed to be, and then she backed off when she was supposed to.
And you were aware of this? You would observe this?
Yes, but I couldn't do that. When it was mine, I couldn't. I had a hard time doing that when Pat came back.
Backing it back.
Yeah, when he was in Vietnam, that was one of the problems that we had, was because I had taken care of everything.
Okay.
I got my bills back. I know I'm not in order here, but I had taken care of all the bills. I was able to save money because I was living at home. And then when he came back, it was his turn to take care of everything, and I had already had it all set up the way I wanted.
And you had a child, right?
Yes. Yeah. And he had, as far as I was concerned, had no clue how to take care of a child. Because he, you know, he was the oldest of his family. He, you know, and we hadn't been around kids together. So, you know, anyway. But I did learn a lot of, independent type, I hate to say tricks, but things from my mother to survive some of the hard things that I did go through. Hmm.
That's good to hear.
Yeah.
Whenever when we're talking here in this interview, please feel free to bring that up. That you, if you were able to survive certain situations in your life as we go through things from your mom, talk about that and what you saw from her. So it sounds like she was very hardworking, but also dedicated to your father, and that the traveling suited her.
Yes,
she wanted to see the world like your, I guess your father did as well.
Yes.
Okay, so Japan and then back to Florida, and is this where your memories really start kind of
getting
crystal clear?
Yeah, I started first grade there, but then back then we didn't have to go to kindergarten, so I started first grade there, things that I remember from Florida, this Eglin Air Force Base is not far from the Gulf Coast,
right.
And we used to go to the beach a lot. I remember my second grade school teacher. I don't remember her name. Slammed my finger in a door at school. They had to sew the top of my finger back on. That was one big trauma. Then after that, we went to France, and that's one of the things I really remember. I was 10 by that time.
That's an incredible experience for a young girl to have.
Well, I didn't know any better. I mean, I really didn't know any better. And that was one of the things that, as I got older, I'm going to be skipping around here.
That's fine.
Okay,
that's
all right.
Fine.
When we moved to France, the flight over was absolutely horrid. My sister and I both were airsick the whole way. It was a propeller flight, you know, no jets for passengers and stuff like that yet. And then when we went to France, my mom tells me we were on a ship for several weeks, well, a couple of weeks or a week, I can't remember, and we were sick then, and she was using regular diapers and the whole, I mean, we were both little, and so, you know, my traveling days were a whole lot better than what she went through.
Right.
So, anyway, once we got to France, I mean, it was just what we had to do. We lived in first town we lived in was called Sampigny, and it's spelled S-A-M-P-I-G-N-E-E.
Okay.
It's outside, it's not there anymore, but it was Tours Air Force Base.
Okay.
We were about 30 miles. Actually, no, I'm sorry. That's the second town we lived in. We lived, the first one was San Miguel. It's M-I-G-U-E-L. Mm-hmm. Anyway, we lived there for just a couple of months. And then we moved to Sampigny and we lived in a bakery. Then we moved again to guaranteed housing. And in this 2 years, we moved four times. And then we moved again. We were there 6 months. So we moved three times while we were there for the 2 years.
It's incredible.
And we had to boil our water. It was just like going to Mexico, you know. Primitive, but we didn't know. We didn't know any better. My dad had to bring groceries in because we only had one car. He would bring the groceries in. I would go to the base once a month. I would drink a lot of Kool-Aid. Didn't have a lot of fresh stuff. I didn't know any better.
What was France like?
The small town was very nice. It was like in the 50s in the States, you know, what I hear. We could walk around in town in the evening, my sister and I. We could go to the bakery and pick up fresh bread for dinner or go to the meat market or whatever.
Could you speak some French?
Not at that time.
Okay.
When I went to school, this was kind of weird. Our first day at school, first time we had to go to school, we moved there in December. We had to get up at, of course my sister remembers a little bit differently than I do, but we had to catch a staff car. He'd come and pick up all the kids, the American kids that lived in this town. This was in St. Mihiel the first time. We had to get up at 4 so we could catch this car by 5. Then we went to a bus depot and waited for all these people would come in, and then we'd get the school bus and travel for about another 45 minutes to school.
Wow.
That was the same on the way back.
Wow.
And see, I don't remember in Florida how I got to school. I think I rode a bus. Yeah, I did ride a bus to school. So that wasn't a big deal. But we didn't know any better. So anyway.
That's a lot. That's tough. It sounds like it was a kind of a hard life there.
It was. It was. The military housing was not very abundant back then. And they were, I really don't know the politics of what was going on there, but I knew it wasn't, I knew that they were just sending them over like crazy. Mm-hmm. I know after we moved to Germany, after France, that the communist threat was very, very high. There was a lot of stuff I'll tell you about Germany later. Okay. As a kid. I'm not talking about Vietnam very much.
We'll get there. I really want to know, you're really hitting it on the head here with the times as far as France is concerned and what you're remembering. Do you remember how the French people treated you and your sister?
Yes.
Or in general, how they treated your parents?
Once, well, when we rented our second place, we rented from a family. Mm-hmm. And we got to be, once you got to know the French people, they were your friends for life. But that, it was a hard crust to get through.
Right.
Even though you always heard about, it was still close to the end of World War II.
Yeah, yes.
This was 57 and 58. And they were all very happy that we had been there to liberate them. Mm-hmm. And all that stuff. Mm-hmm. But they were still trying to build up, and as far as they were concerned, we weren't there really to protect them, but we were occupying. This is what I understood. That's why we were kind of resentful.
Right.
And we had money. We had lots of money compared to what they had.
What they had been through, really devastated them.
And so they were still building, and that was one thing that I didn't understand. I had been on my grandpa's farm, and it was a poor place, and so this was a poor, I mean, I just didn't know any better.
Right.
Like, you know. At least we had indoor plumbing, you know.
Right.
So, anyway.
Did you see any ruins from the war? Did you see
any? I'll get to that in a minute.
Go ahead.
We used to go out. We had to be careful. And I don't know, Pat probably told you this, because they went to wherever they were at in Okinawa. Same mm-hmm. thing. Mm-hmm. There were places marked off where you couldn't go. It was the roads were blocked off.
Where Americans couldn't go?
No, anybody. They had not been searched for mines. There were still live mines in there. There was, all kinds of stuff. All kinds of, there was still camp. Well, we would go sometimes in the woods. And especially after we got to the very last place we went was a brand new housing project. Mm-hmm. And there was no grass or anything yet, so we would go out in these ditches. Mm-hmm. And I found bullet casings. One kid found a helmet. Found opened canned food things from mm-hmm. World War II. So there was still a lot of stuff out there that you could find.
Wow.
But that was the biggest fear, was kids going out and just walking around mm-hmm. getting blown up.
Mm-hmm.
And I respected that. I was old enough to understand that.
Was your father, was he really strict with you all when he was there? Or was he more caught up in his duties and letting your mom kind of run the show?
Let me put this up front. My mom and dad got divorced in 1986.
Okay. Wow.
And it was a very, very hard thing for all of us to go through, even as my sisters and I were adults at that time.
Yes.
So, what I say here is what I recollect. my sisters have a different recollection of after the divorce, thing changed about what they remembered from what I remember. Mm-hmm. But of course, I feel like I'm more right because I was older.
You were older, sure.
So, but I, you know, my dad was my dad, and I didn't have another father, and I didn't know some of the things that he did was probably not right. But he never had a real dad to learn from.
Right.
So most of it came from my mom. Most of the stuff that we observed and our learning was from our mother. My dad was there, yes, for discipline. Mm-hmm. Yes, for advice when it was needed. But basically it was my mom. My dad did work long hours. He didn't run around. He didn't, I mean, hang out at bars or anything like that. But he was very involved with mm-hmm. his job.
Okay.
I did not feel that we were badly treated.
Okay.
But if you talk to my sister, that's a different story.
Well, this is your interview.
Yeah.
This is what you remember.
So, you know, he was always there when I needed him mm-hmm. for anything. You know, if I needed something. Sometimes he was there when I didn't want to.
Right. Sure.
So, but anyway.
Was that a good thing for you, looking back in hindsight, as living overseas, Japan, France, and then you're going to be in Germany next?
France scared me because it was kind of foreign. The language was really different. The mm-hmm. German language was a little bit closer to mm-hmm. the English language. Mm-hmm. And I was thrown right into school immediately.
When you went to Germany?
No, to France.
To France, okay.
And my classroom, everyone was a third grade and fourth grade together in one classroom. And every Wednesday, we would alternate going to a French boys' school. At that time, I don't know if it still is, but the boys and girls didn't go to school together okay. in France. And so on Wednesday, the third graders would go to the third grade class, and then the fourth grade boys would come to our class, and then we would switch to next Wednesday.
Okay.
One of the things that I really remember just scared me to death. We went to my first time at the French school. They had a model house up in front of the classroom. And he was having the American kids go up and say the parts of the house. Well, it was my first day. I didn't know any French. I was so afraid that he was going to, you know.
Right.
And then he started writing on the board, and I couldn't understand the letters. They write in a very fluent, almost old English, not old English, but script, mm-hmm. like back in the 1780s and stuff.
So you're thrown right into a French school?
Yes.
At, what, 10, 11 years old?
10. Mm-hmm.
And you didn't speak French?
Nope.
And you had to go to all that trouble to get to the school? That must have been a huge shock. Go ahead.
Well, so anyway, but we did have a partner. And the kid that I had was a partner, took a lot of pity on me. We were supposed to be writing stuff down. He finally took my notebook and started writing for me because I was just almost in tears.
Oh.
I didn't know what to do. I didn't know what they wanted me to do. He was giving instructions in French. These kids have already been there for a whole semester, or about half a year, you know. And this is in December, you know, trying to get, I was totally.
And you remember that feeling. You remember.
Oh, it was horrible, horrible. Oh. So anyway, I got through that. That was okay. And then, so then we went to Germany. Okay, and I did learn French. I mean, I had to learn French.
Yes.
And especially living in the French towns and stuff.
Yes.
You know, we learned enough. You know, how much does it cost? Where's the bathroom? That cost too much, you know, and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So we learned enough to get by. And of course, kids pick it up a little bit quicker. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And then we moved to Germany. And we lived on base, Hahn Air Force Base, which is a base up on the mountain, and it's still there.
Hmm.
I don't believe they closed that one down yet. It's not far from Ramstein and all the ones that you know, everybody hears about.
This is 1959?
Yes.
Okay.
And at that time, 1960, mm-hmm. while we were there, the Iron Curtain and the wall in Berlin went up.
Okay.
And this is one thing that I feel is unique about me, is because I was there when the wall went up. And we were in Berlin when it went down.
That's very
so funny. I remember the feeling of at noon when I would come home for lunch, they went through the series of sirens of all the different things that we had to do with each different siren.
In case of attack?
Yes.
By the East Germans or the Soviets?
Yeah. What we had to do. And same thing, my mom had to have the suitcase ready enough for 3 days. We had to keep a half a tank of gas in the car at all times so that we had a, in case there was an exit. That wasn't for us. That was for them because they would confiscate the car. And that was the same when we lived there. We wouldn't have a car anymore.
Did you know that?
When I was
at
a kid?
The time?
Yes. No, but my mom told me later because when I told her that, she said, well, we had to do the same thing.
So they would have taken the family car,
yes,
essentially, and
yes,
you all would have been left to get out of there on foot.
Well, no, what they do is they had an evacuation plan, and I learned more about this as I was there with my own family, with my girls.
You're talking about they being the United States military?
Yes.
Okay.
What they did was, and they had to change the plan, I forget what they called it, there's a certain word that they used to call it. Anyway, I can't remember. They would come get you in a bus. Then they would use it. Then this is the part that changed our route to get to the aircraft. It might have been a regular aircraft. Mm-hmm. It might have been a military equipment where they put the tanks and stuff. Mm-hmm. It just depended. And they would have to change the route so that. And that was always secret. Nobody knew how we were going to really ever get out of there, which buildings would be taken first, your pets would be left behind. Yeah.
Did you know that?
Yes, I did. But my husband told me, he said, I'm going to know before it's time. And you are leaving with the kids and the dogs and everything. We've always had dogs, so. He said, and you're going to be gone before anything happens. I said, okay. My dad said, you're not going to leave when everybody else goes. He said, you're going to go. If you don't have a car, they're going to take the car. You're going to walk. You're going to walk to Switzerland. And that's what he told my mom. He says, I might not be able to get home. He said, but you're going to walk to Switzerland.
So
what you're going to do.
As soon as the evacuation siren sounded, saying that there was a Soviet attack of some kind.
That's what he wanted us to do.
Wow.
Now, we didn't have, all we had was a parakeet. I mean, when I was a kid, when we lived there. So that wasn't a big deal. And he flew away. So, I don't know. I went through the whole gamut of the... I'm sorry I'm skipping around here, but the comparisons are...
Absolutely.
I don't remember. I remember my mom telling me that when we lived in Japan, they had a couple practice evacuations. Where we went, we sat in a building with our suitcase and everything for a few hours. I went on a couple of volunteer evacuations when we lived in Germany.
You and Pat, or you?
No, my girls.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, Lynn was in school, but Kathy was still, mm-hmm, the youngest one was still a little dumb. And they took us, and we sat on a, I don't know what, it's one of those airplanes with the back drops down.
C-130 or
yeah,
C-5.
Where they put the tanks and the equipment up there. Mm-hmm. And we had... our blankets and our supplies, and we had, if we had to go to the bathroom, you had to go to the bathroom with a coffee can with the blanket around it. That was your toilet.
Wow.
So we were all, no seats, and that was the one of the things, even if it was a civilian airline that they, mm-hmm, confiscated or took whatever, mm-hmm, all those seats would have been taken out, because the idea was to take civilians back, bring back equipment and troops. Take civilians back, bring back, so there would be no seats.
Right.
So we were packed in there like sardines sitting on the floor.
I find it interesting that you were there in France and then in Germany, as a little girl, fighting the Cold War, basically. You know, your dad's serving there on the front line of the Cold War. And then years later, when you're married to Pat, you're in the exact same position, but you're in your mother's situation where you're protecting your family, and you're right there on the front lines of the Cold War once again, literally at Berlin.
In Berlin, we were.
At the end there. So were you aware as a child, I guess age 11 and 12, 13, of the significance of what was happening in the world, the Cold War, that the Soviets were the enemy or communism was the enemy? How much did you understand? Because I would imagine that would certainly shape your attitudes toward the communists in Vietnam later, where you're thinking these are the same kind of quote-unquote red tide
I missed about 4 years of TV from 57 to 61.
Yes,
okay, as a kid.
Right.
So I missed a lot of the where they used to hide under their desk, and you see it on TV and all that stuff, and I'm going, that wouldn't have done any good for us.
Right.
Yeah, we did that. Anyway, so I didn't understand all that part, what that would do if there was an atomic whatever going on, because to me that was never a fear. They would never use, as far as I was concerned, atomic warfare where I was living at that time. I knew about the atomic bomb because we learned about it in school in Hiroshima and all that, so I knew that. I knew that we were close to the bad guys. And I guess whenever anything like that, I always put it in the back of my mind. I knew there was a plan. I knew what we were going to do. And I just would leave everything and leave. I don't know how. I just did like my mom. Yeah. When your time comes, your time comes. I mean, that's basically the way I was looking at it. I mean, I could have got hit by a car or walked across the street.
Sure.
We had, I'm getting mixed up here. Okay, so we were in Germany.
Tell me again, where in Germany?
Hahn Air Force Base.
H-A-H-N, Hahn?
H-A-H-N. It means rooster.
You remember that. Okay, and where was Hahn located? Do you remember?
It's on a mountain north of Trauben, Traubach. T-R-A-U-B-E-N. Do you care?
For the transcriptions,
it's Trauben, Traubach. That was a little town just south of, just below the mountain.
And how do you spell it?
It's T-R-A-U-B-E-N. Then I think it's a dash Trau, T-R-A-U, then B-A-C-H. Trauben is grapes.
Okay.
So, anyway.
Is this northern West Germany or southern West Germany? It has to have been near the border with Switzerland, I guess. Or close to
it's in central Germany, but okay. I can't remember if it's not as east as Kaiserslautern where we were. It's more to a little bit west, so it's more central.
Okay.
Anyway.
Do you remember how the German people were? How they treated you in compared to what the French?
Well, see, I went to an American school, so I didn't have a whole lot of connections with the German people at that time. We had a German maid, and what I know of the German people now was when I was there with my husband.
Okay.
My dad said the same thing happened when we were there with Pat, was that whenever you met a German, their husband or their brother, or they all fought on the Russian front. They never fought on the Western front.
Right.
So, I as a child didn't have hardly any contact with the German people at all. I think we only had one car. I can't remember. Yeah, we only had one car. Yeah, I don't think we ever had two cars.
So, had you accepted the military life? Did you understand that, you know, this would be a moving...
Oh, yeah.
How did all the moving affect you? This is the obvious question to ask an Air Force kid. But how did that affect you? Did you deal with it okay?
When I was a kid, it didn't bother me. I the longest until we retired here, how old was I? 43? Well, until I was 43 years old, the longest I had ever lived in the same house was 3.5 years. And that was at Eglin Air Force Base. We lived 3.5 years.
Wow.
And then we lived here 12, 13 years. And that's it.
So, looking back, how do you think that affected you, all that moving?
Me, personally, I didn't know any different. I don't think, I talk to people and they just go, couldn't do that. And there were people, women, that their guys were stationed over in Germany and they stayed behind.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them didn't make it. You know, it was a strain.
Yeah.
I enjoyed the moving until my oldest daughter started going to college. That kind of started separating the family. We acquired more and more stuff.
Mm-hmm.
This last time when we went to Germany in 86, I had to have 3 different shipments. And I always would get hyper and excited and upset and make myself sick over it. I had to have a shipment called whole baggage, which is like 600 or 700 pounds of stuff to get you by until your whole, until your regular baggage gets there, all your stuff. This was different because we had to take our own furniture this time. Normally, the government provides you with their furniture.
And this is in 86 with PATH?
Yes. But we were going to Kaiserslautern and they didn't provide all that. This is when the moving started to really bother me.
Okay.
And then I had to take another bunch of stuff for storage for 4 years. So, if you're working, I just don't know how you can do it. I was going to school, so it wasn't that bad. I still had time to do what I needed to do to get it done. So that's the part that really started to bother me. The more stuff we got, the harder it was to move.
Right. That makes sense. So you leave Germany and you go back to Arizona. Over to Arizona.
When I was
correct?
A kid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a huge move.
We all got sick. Because the weather was so completely different.
Really different, yeah.
Now,
what did your dad do in Arizona? He was...
Well, my father, he was stationed at Williams Air Force Base.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a jet engine mechanic.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and he started working on the jet engines. He wanted to fly, but I can't remember why. He was too old, I think, by the time he came back from Korea, to go through the pilot program. They had a bunch of young ones that wanted to come in, so I think that might have been the problem. Japan. He started working with the jet engines in Florida.
Okay.
And that's where he really got into that's what he did until he retired, was he worked on the jet engines.
Okay. So you're there in 1961 and you're there for 3 years, is that correct, in Arizona?
Yes.
And I know it's hard to remember back that we're talking about.
Yeah, I have to go by my grades in school, and I don't know how many military, you probably talked to a lot of military people, but when you talk about something, about a year, they go back to where they were stationed or where they lived.
Yes.
Not by the year. It's hard for me to go by the years. I have to go by where I was.
So you see Arizona and you see what for you?
Something different.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Middle
yeah.
school. This is middle school. This is
yes,
junior high
started,
school.
Yes, I started 8th grade.
Okay.
And I'll back up a minute. I went to 6th grade in an attic. When we were in hot air base, and then my 7th grade was in a Quonset hut because they didn't have room in the regular school building for us. And once you got to 10th grade, you had to board at like Ramstein or something like that. You couldn't stay there. So, yeah. Anyway, so I go there, and now I go to a full-fledged civilian school.
Okay.
hadn't been to a civilian school all my whole life.
Right. What was that like?
The first thing that I noticed was prejudice.
Really?
I had never encountered prejudice in my life. Now, this is, what's that, 13, 14 years old?
Mm-hmm.
Eighth grade?
What kind of prejudice did you see?
It was towards the Indian people. Mm. And this was in 61 and 62.
Mm-hmm. This is right at the cusp of the modern American civil rights movement here.
We lived in a small town, Chandler, Arizona. It's not small anymore.
Right.
But it was a farm town, ranchers mostly and stuff. But the kids just didn't tolerate the Indian people. They were nasty. They lived with their animals inside their homes. I couldn't find anything wrong with it. I mean, I never did. When I was a kid growing up, there were black people around us. There was nothing ever mentioned, ever.
That's very interesting.
So even against the French people that, you know, kind of resented us and stuff like that, never was anything mentioned. And I saw it first at school.
Hmm.
And they were talking about, we're not sitting over there. Da, da, da.
Right. What kind of student were you? I know it was difficult in France, for sure, and then you're in Germany on a base school, but tell me about just how you were academically.
I was a real poor student in elementary school. I was lazy.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to play outside. We lived in Florida. I mean, yeah, lots of places to play, lots of things to do.
Sure.
When we went to Germany, well, gotta play outside before the weather gets bad, you know, gotta be outside, you know. So I really liked to be outside. And then I made a real good grade in math in sixth grade. And that kind of showed me that I could actually do something.
Mm-hmm.
I was a real poor reader. And that carried through to my junior high years and my high school. And that made me a real poor English student as far as grammar goes. I knew all about Shakespeare, I knew all about all the literature and stuff like that, but the grammar part, and this is the part that sucked about being moving around, was that once you got up to the junior high, high school stuff, they split up those literature and grammar things back in those days. Mm-hmm. One semester this, one semester that. And when I got to where I was going, it was always the literature they were on.
Mm-hmm.
So I missed a lot of grammar.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to have a real low. And when I started college, I had to take a course to get me up to par with the regular college kids. So when I really started, so that was the only bad thing. As far as the academics and math and science and everything, when we came back from Germany, I was actually ahead of everybody else.
Hmm. What were your favorite subjects?
Math and this chemistry and things like that. Because I was so poor in the English thing.
Right.
And so that's what I carried through with. So.
Okay. So in Arizona, you're there for 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're going to move yet again, this time to San Antonio,
mm-hmm.
to Randolph Air Force Base. And I know this is where Pat met you, or you met Pat. But tell me about San Antonio. Was it an easy transition, staying within the United States this time?
Yeah, it was fine. It was the weather was different. Arizona at that time was still pretty dry.
Mm-hmm.
Arizona was real hot and sticky. Again, we had to have a big adjustment to that. First time we ever had to have an air conditioner in my life. Always had a water cooler or something. Never had to have an air conditioner before. Went into 10th grade.
It's
1964? Mm-hmm. No, 63, 64, 65, 60. Well, I was there 10th through 12th grade. I graduated in 66.
Okay.
So back up 3 years or whatever.
Okay.
At that time, the enlisted and officers were segregated. We had our own pool. The officers had their pool. So it was the same wing school. It was segregated, basically.
Wow.
And so there was, I didn't realize it, but that was a prejudice of a sort, of course. They had the good clothes. They had stuff from the thrift shop, things like that. And that's when I really started noticing what was going on.
And which was what? Just
the clothes that the kids had, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Of course, we all hung out. The enlisted kids all hung out together, and the officers' kids hung out. And we didn't live in the same area.
Right. So you saw
it's not that way now, but it's, well, it is a little bit, but it's not as bad as it was back then.
So you're talking about differences between the enlisted families and the officer families.
Yes, and they, this is my own personal opinion, the officers' kids made a point of that, saying that, you know, we are better, look at what we have, look what you don't have, look at the car my dad drives, look at this, that, and there, so.
How'd you feel about all that?
I didn't like it.
Now, what did you do academically? How did you do there in high school?
I did very well.
Yeah. Okay. And same subject still, what you wanted, what you
Yeah, and I took, as a matter of fact, I took French, because I knew more German. I knew a lot more German than I did French, so I took French in high school.
Hmm.
And I did very well.
What about sports?
Well, When I was in junior high, I played baseball, mm-hmm. basketball, because I was tall.
Mm-hmm.
When we went to I'm trying to remember. I thought I went there in 10th grade. Maybe it was only 11th and 12th grade. I can't remember now.
It's fine.
Okay. We joined the, my sister and I joined the cadets, which is like a pep squad, marching squad.
Mm-hmm.
And so we didn't have PE per se, that was our PE class.
Okay.
And I did that for I think it was only 2 years I was there.
Okay.
So, yeah, 8th, 9th, and 10th in Arizona, and then 11th and 12th. And so it was the 2 years there that we did the that. And so that was our PE.
Were your parents pushing you to go to college, or were you thinking yourself, I want to go to
college?
Oh,
yeah. Oh, yeah.
Which one? Both? Or?
Yes, both.
Okay, so there was an expectation that you would continue your education,
exactly.
And you wanted to?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
What about going into the military? Had you explored that idea?
Yes, but I wasn't going to go in as an enlisted person. And
based on what you had seen? Okay.
And women were not allowed to go to the academies.
Right.
I thought at one time I also wanted to be a park ranger, because I love the, you know, I love camping and being outside and everything. And they weren't allowed to be park rangers either.
You remember feeling that?
Yeah, I didn't understand it. I understand it. But, I mean, I never belonged to a protest group or never did anything. I was just, well, okay, that's what it is. I'm going to find something else I have to do. Yeah,
you
something else that I like to do. Yeah.
Right.
So, I mean, it was a big deal, but what could I do about
right.
it?
Right. You decided to move on and do what you could. Let me ask you this, and you certainly don't have to answer this. How would you describe your family politically? Were you all politically aware, or and if you were, if you did discuss politics, or maybe if you did not, do you remember kind of where you all fell on the political spectrum? Did your father vote Democrat and your mother vote Democrat, or was it, do you remember any of that?
No. They never really talked about it.
Mm-hmm.
Until I was in high school, and my dad voted for Goldwater. I mean, because we were in Arizona and everything, and
right.
Goldwater did president. I don't remember. No, that's all I remember.
Okay.
There was really no push one way or the other for anything. So.
Do you remember John Kennedy when you were young?
Yes. As a matter of fact, we got a television set. We were getting ready to leave to come back to States, and he was campaigning in, he was getting ready to be elected in 60, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, 1959, someone got a TV set, and we were able to get an interview of him and Nixon on the TV. It was real snowy.
Right.
But that was my first real interaction with what was going on. What's going on with Thea.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Do you remember when he was shot and killed in 1963?
Oh, yes. Everybody remembers where they were.
Tell me about that.
I was in typing class in Chandler, Arizona. And I was right, 10th grade. I think it was my last year there. And there was some hollering in the hallway. And the teacher went out, and she came in, and she said, we're all going to the auditorium. The president's been shot. Of course, nobody knew. He was just shot. That's
right.
All we knew.
Right.
So, and the school was not a big school. So we all went down the auditorium. We were watching TV. Then I started getting, and of course, this was like one of the first, like the Vietnam War was on TV. This was just prior to live stuff happening in front of you. Mm-hmm. You don't read it in the paper or you don't see it in the evening news. Mm-hmm. It's happening right now. Mm-hmm. As that was one of the first times that we'd ever seen anything like that. So they all sent us home. Mm-hmm. And crying, I was crying, you know. We turned the TV on, and then they finally told us he had died. And we all thought the world was coming to an end. Hmm. I mean, we're going to go to war. This is it. He's the only one that saved us from Castro, you know. The Russians are going to come. This is it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But we were already in the States, and, you know, so, you know, Dad would have to leave, maybe, but
right.
That would have been it,
right.
You know. But we were all scared. We were all really scared.
Those are some powerful memories.
Oh, yeah.
What about Lyndon Johnson? Did you anybody know a little bit about him?
I didn't know anything about him. No.
Okay.
Not at that time. I do now.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. Well, tell me about meeting Pat. Were you lifeguarding? Is that correct?
He was.
He was lifeguarding.
Yes, I caught a lifeguard.
Good for you. And an older one at that, right?
Yeah, I was 16 and he was 19.
Okay.
I don't know how much he told you. But after I met him, we were engaged when I was 17. I was still in high school. And then my dad retired in 66, mm-hmm. and we moved to California.
Right.
And he was my first love, first one I'd ever really been with and everything. And so I said, well, we moved to California. I said, I don't know if I want to do this or not. You know? So I flew back and I broke up. And it was mutual. I mean, it was too soon for me. I was
mm-hmm.
only 17.
Mm-hmm.
And
but you were engaged or not?
We were engaged, but then we broke up.
Ah, okay.
I had a ring and everything.
Okay.
I came back and I said, Pat, you know, just starting college, you know, I don't, you know,
mm-hmm.
same old town. So anyway, then he joined the Army and was stationed at Fort Ord and would come down every now and then. We were engaged, but then he went, after he went to Fort Ord, then he applied to OCS, got OCS, and was stationed in Maryland. We were engaged 5 times.
Wow. On and off.
On and off. Very stubborn relationship. But anyway, we finally decided to get married through letters. And so he graduated on the 14th, I think, of December, and we were married on the 23rd.
Okay.
It took us a while, but we finally got there.
This is 1967. So you met him in 65?
I met him in, yes.
65.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that seems appropriate that you guys were separated by geography and telephone lines. I mean, that's difficult.
It took us a while, but we finally decided that we were ready for each other.
Okay.
It took us a while.
Now,
most of me. But I was young. I was too young.
You think that today you still were, you were too young to get married at that point? Okay.
Oh yeah, he didn't have a job.
He was in the Army though.
Yeah, but he was enlisted.
Yes, but didn't he just complete OCS?
Yeah, well, that it was after
that changed things.
Yeah.
Yes, I see. Okay.
Not that I was being prejudiced or not, but I just saw the life I saw the life of what was happening.
That's what actually how he described it as well, that he knew that as an enlisted man, he was going to be limited in his options. And you know, he wanted to become an officer, for sure. So now, after you're married, well, before you're married, did you think about, here I'm going to now go into this military lifestyle of moving again, probably, mm-hmm. constantly. And that's what you're used to, so that was no problem?
Because we had just moved there in 66, mm-hmm. the summer of 66, to California. And we were married, so I was only there about a year and a half.
Okay.
It was no big deal.
What did you know about Vietnam at this point?
My parents lived on a street, Fiddler Street, and there were some kids
in California
mm-hmm. that had been sent over, and some of them didn't come back. I did not know them personally, but some of the young people that I knew out on the street did know them, and that kind of hit close to home there. I didn't know anybody who had been going until we actually, you know, we were married and we were stationed at Fort Hood. Then they were taking people to go.
Right. Do you remember asking questions or listening to the news or listening to your parents talk or friends talk about why the United States was in Vietnam when you were in California? Mm-hmm. Nothing like that?
Mm-hmm. All I really knew was that it was North Vietnam, and they were communists, and they wanted to take over. To me, it was the same as the communists wanting to take over, you know, mm-hmm. Germany and all that again. Mm-hmm. To me, it was very similar.
Okay, all right.
Whether it was or not, that's what I saw.
Right. Did you and Pat talk about the possibility of him going?
Oh, yeah.
When did that conversation start? When did you first start thinking about this? Was it before you were married?
I knew he was going to go. He was a second. He was a second lieutenant, mm-hmm. and I knew he was going to have to go. And I just knew he was going to have to go. But
because of his rank,
I kept hoping that things would end. Yes, because he was. Yes, because of his rank.
Okay.
And I knew this at this time. They were turning out second lieutenants like, just because they needed them over there so bad. And and that followed us through his career. There were so many every time there was promotion time coming up, there was, I don't know how much he talked about that part, but that was kind of a detriment in him getting promoted at certain times.
There are always a numerous amount of...
Yes, that part of the rift.
Yes.
That sort of thing happened because there were so many at his rank level. Okay. Offered people early retirement.
How did you feel about your husband, your new husband, going off to war?
Well, I don't know. It was a service. I mean, he was going to have to go, and that's just the way it is. And I knew that I'd go home. My family was always there for me, and I wasn't going to live by myself. In Texas, you know, I wasn't going to do it. Some of the wives did if they didn't want to go. I said, I'm not going to live here by myself. Mm-hmm. Especially, I was 7 months pregnant. Let me back up a little bit.
Okay.
He volunteered to go. I don't know if he told you that.
He did.
Yes. That's the little sore spot that I have, is that he volunteered to go.
Tell me
he was
that.
Ready to go out and kill the bad guys and get rid of them and do great things and all that stuff. And my dad was pretty much the same way, and I cried and cried. I said, oh, you're going to leave me, I'm going to have a baby by myself, you know, and everything. Mm-hmm. But I accepted it. I didn't accept it. What is that word? I tolerated it, I guess.
Well, it seems that, you know, when I guess he comes home.
I supported him.
He comes home and tells you, I'm going to Vietnam.
And then he did break down, and he finally told me that he volunteered. He told me he was going first, and then he said, well, I volunteered to go. They needed me to go. And I said,
obviously, weren't happy with
no.
But
I wanted him there I guess I was about, well, it took us, I don't remember from the time he volunteered to how when we had to leave, but by the time we left, I was 7 months pregnant. By the time we left, and I really wanted him to be there. You know, I was scared. I knew my family was going to be there, but, you know, it's your first child and all that stuff, so. And what if something happened to him? You know, he would never see her.
Right.
You know.
So he volunteers, and you're going to have a baby in 2 months, and that had to be difficult. Were you told how the Army might take care of you and the wives while the husbands are gone?
Yes, I could have stayed in Government House. Well, we didn't have Government House. There wasn't any room. We would have had to pay rent. We lived in a trailer, but not a travel trailer, but a house trailer. Mm-hmm. And I would have had to stay in that and pay rent. Mm-hmm. I think it was like $200 a month. It was ridiculous. No, $75 a month at that time.
Wow.
Yeah. It was pretty. But I had a new washer, a new stove. You know, some of the people that paid $85 for a house in town, you know, lived in like basic shacks. They had to have their own stuff.
Was this government supplied? You all had to pay for all of it.
Yeah. Now, what happens in the military is you get a government. If you can't get on base or post, they give you extra money to supposedly cover your rent.
Right.
And so when he did leave, I would have stayed there. I think we still would have gotten the money for the rent, but I'm not really sure. Of course, you got hazardous duty pay too, so, so it would have been okay. But I didn't know anybody. I didn't want to be there by myself.
Okay.
We had friends, but it's not the same thing.
Right. Especially if you don't have a baby. You need some help.
Yeah, exactly. Especially my first one. I was really ignorant, you know.
Right. Well, tell me about the time. You know, he knows when he's going to go, and you're working your way toward that. What were you thinking and feeling? Did you try to learn more about Vietnam?
Yes. I looked at the map and to figure out where he was going to go. I learned more about the French people that were there and why they were there. And then I understood, maybe this isn't so good actually.
Really?
Is this about money or what?
You remember thinking that?
Yes, yeah.
Did you, were educating yourself on this place?
Well, yeah, I was kind of upset. And then my dad was working for an aircraft company, and he went to Vietnam as a civilian.
Really?
And so we learned more about that side of it too. About his
did family. He go before Pat?
I can't remember.
But you just remember accumulating knowledge.
Yeah, I think he. I don't remember when he went.
That's
but
very
it was before or after. Yeah. So. Anyway, yes, I did try to find out what was going on. But one of the problems I had was if even if I could watch the news, of course, every day. Well, okay, let's back up. So anyway, what else do you want to know before I left?
Well,
I'm jumping around.
Well, it's okay. Tell me about, you know, you made plans to go to California and live with your folks.
Yeah.
Tell me about wrapping up there in San Antonio and what that was like.
Okay, well, we didn't have a whole lot of stuff because of the furniture. Well, the big thing things was is how to get me out there. They didn't want me to fly. I wasn't supposed to ride in the car for very long. So we were kind of stuck at what to do. So we decided to just go ahead and drive and take our time getting out there. So that's what we did.
He had, 30 days leave before he went?
Yeah, pretty much. And then I think he went through San Francisco. Yeah, but I couldn't go with him. I was already too far, almost 8 by that time. So.
What did you say to him when he left? Well, the last time you were going to see him?
When he returned? I don't remember. I just knew I was going to be able to see him in Hawaii.
Right. You planned for R&R.
And so
Hawaii.
That's what I focused on. And we talked. He told me that we would be able to talk on the phone through the Mars system. And so that's what we were able to do a couple of times. Mm-hmm. And we wrote letters to each other every day. You know, even though I didn't get them every day. I'd get like 3 or 4, 5, 6 in, you know, four or five days, whatever.
Right.
Watched the news every day.
What was that like, watching the war on TV? This is the first television war for the United States.
Yeah. It was scary to me. And a lot of the time I said, well, he's not with them, he's not with them. As a matter of fact, I don't even remember if he told me what unit he was in, because I knew he was ordnance. Mm-hmm. And I knew ordnance weren't grunts. Mm-hmm. They weren't on the ground. They weren't fighting with their weapons. Mm-hmm. They weren't. He was in the back at a fire station, whatever they call it.
Firebase.
Fixing equipment, mm-hmm. or going and digging stuff out and fixing it. So he wasn't actually in the line of fire, as far as I knew.
Right.
Then I found out that he was with the 1st Cav for the first 6 months he was there.
Yes.
And by the time I got his letters, he wasn't there anymore where he had been, because they moved. Mm-hmm. They moved constantly for that first 6 months. And then I don't remember where he was the last part. But he was pretty sedentary, I think, by that time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so did you immediately start writing the letters and
oh, yeah.
all of that? Okay. Yeah. How long would it take for your letters to get there and his letters to get to you, on average?
Sometimes 4 days, sometimes a week.
And how could you differentiate between which letters to read first?
I would look at the date at the top, pretty much, because it would leave. They had, like, I think they still had it back then. Sam, the military postmarks would be on the, yeah.
Okay.
Sometimes they'd open up the wrong one first.
What did the Army do for you while he was away for that year?
I didn't really need anything, so I never even asked. The only thing, this is kind of horrible, the only thing that Pat kept pounding into me and my mom and dad and my sisters is that if anything happened to him, they were going to come to me first, not his mom and dad in San Antonio. And it would always be, he got promoted to first lieutenant there. He said it would be somebody his rank or higher and a minister, a military minister. If anybody else, MPs, anybody else comes to the door and says anything to you about me not, you know, I've been hit or anything, there shouldn't even be a telegram or anything like they did in World War II. Mm-hmm. He said, don't believe me. You call, I think it was, what was that one? There was a military installation in Long Beach there. Get a hold of the chaplain and stuff there and they'll take care of it. Or the Red Cross.
Okay. How much did you think about that?
About every day.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
Especially with the new baby.
Yeah. I was young when he left, and everything was going to be honky-dory, and nothing's going to happen to him, and until then came along, and then we went to R&R. She was 4 months old when we went, June or July. And he had lost one of his friends. And I said, you know, I've been talking to some of the other ladies, you know, that are around here, and some that were in the hospital with me. And I said, they're not going to bring their babies because it's too much trouble. We never had a honeymoon. Do you want us to have a honeymoon? And
he right.
said, no, don't come without the baby. Don't come without her. So, because his friend never saw his son.
Right, Chick Chandler.
That kind of hit home to me. It just never, you know, I was so busy, you know, it never really hit home until, you know, he said something like that.
And he told you that in letters? Here's what I want you to do. How did you feel about that, bringing Lynn out there?
Oh, I didn't, but I mean, I'm traveling, I could do anything, mm-hmm. you know, no big deal. I just, you know, was trying to make his R&R as comfortable as possible.
Sure. Did the Army provide you any kind of instructions for how to act during R&R, what not to ask, how to do things?
I don't know who told me, and I don't know where I learned this, but they said he might act a little funny with, like, loud noises, if he jumps out of bed in the middle of the night, or if he just acts a little weird, at stuff. And a couple of times he did actually do that. There was a...
In Hawaii?
Yeah. There was a loud noise outside, or a siren went by or something, and he jumped out of bed and got down on the floor. And so I'm glad somebody, I don't remember who told me about that. And so he was awake, so I didn't have to wake him up, but so I was aware of that. Told him it was okay and that. But, so he did have a little bit of, it's understandable.
Sure. Now, in his letters to you before you went to see him in Hawaii, did he tell you, you know, where he was located and everything that was happening, that he was getting mortared and rocketed at this base and the danger
that he
was in?
Not until he came back. He didn't tell. He really didn't tell me. I never pushed him to tell me anything, because some of the stuff I knew was so horrible. In Hawaii and after. I just let him talk. You know, he talked about his friend and... he talked about some of the stuff that he had to do. I don't remember if it was before or after some of the stuff. Mm-hmm. He asked me the other day, he said, I didn't tell you a whole lot about stuff that went on over there, some of the stuff I did. And I said, well, you told me some. Yeah. And I said, I don't remember a lot of it. Some of it I like to push back. I don't like to remember a lot of it. I said, but... this is not very nice. I said, but you told me about the crispy critters, you know, on the concertina wire. You know, he said you had to do that. And it wasn't very much fun. And I said, that was kind of horrible. And I really didn't probably want to hear too much more than that. I don't know how I feel about all this, but a lot of it is what he had to do over there. And then what I had to take care of over here. If I had been over there with him, then I would have had to probably help take care of the same things. Not very pleasant. And I don't know if I could talk about it either. And another thing is that his dad, he told you about his dad, was a prisoner of war.
Yes.
And so he told me his dad never really talked about a lot of stuff until Pat was already 45 or something like that. And never really liked to talk about anything that happened, never told his mother anything. So that was always also in the back of my mind, that I shouldn't really, there's stuff so horrible that he doesn't want to tell me, and why should I make him feel bad about stuff?
Right.
If he ever had to do anything really, really horrible, I don't know if I'd want to know that or not. Unless he needed help with trying to get over something that was so horrible.
Sure. Okay.
So I don't know if that's a bad thing or a good thing.
Well, it seems like that's just the way it was for you all.
And sometimes I think that's the only way I got through things, and it was back here. And I just concentrated on what things that had to be done.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I did.
It seems like that up to this point in your life, when he does leave and go over that, you know, you in your life you were faced with a situation, whether it be, you know, traveling all that distance to school in France, or having to cope with a foreign language at a young age, or whatever, that you just dealt with the situation as it was, you took care of business, and moved forward. And it seems that that is, if I'm hearing you correctly, that's how you dealt also with his service in Vietnam when he left you and someone's pregnant, that you saw it as a service, as you said, and that you didn't have much of a choice. This is the way it's going to be.
Right. That's exactly right.
Did your parents support his involvement in his military career?
I think so. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah.
How about his parents?
I don't know about his dad. I think towards the end, he was real proud of him.
Towards the end of Pat's career?
No, his dad's life.
Okay.
I think Pat had a lot of problems with his mom and dad. He dropped out of school. He spent a lot of money. Pat had a middle brother that was always supposedly the favorite.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, sorry, David. But And so, you know, he was always not really the bastard son, but having a problem with their home.
Sure.
So when he finally did make good and did all that, I think at because Pat became a battalion commander. And,
right.
And I think he proved himself finally to his dad. His mom, I think her boys were just still her boys, no matter how old they were, what they were doing. I don't know how she felt about him being in Vietnam. But she still treated them like boys mm-hmm. up till her time, you know.
How much contact did you have with his family when he was in Vietnam?
I think I talked to them about once or twice a month, you know, because they were concerned about the new baby and everything.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, okay. To let them know, because I don't know how much he wrote to them. And unfortunately, you know, I'd get like a letter here and a letter there, and I could just tell her what I knew at that time. And by the time I talked to them, he still wasn't where he was supposed to be, you know.
Right.
So.
But they would find out news
yeah.
through you eventually.
And if we both heard something different on TV or something scary on TV, we'd call each other. So, mm-hmm. yeah.
Okay. Well, why don't we go ahead and stop for today?
Okay.
This is Dr. Richard Verone. I'm continuing my oral history interview with Diana Curry. Diana and I are, again, in Lubbock, Texas, on the campus of Texas Tech University in the Vietnam Archive Oral History Interview Room. It's August 9th, 2005, and it's 10:10 a.m. Central Standard Time. Diana, why don't we continue with where we were? You all had met in Hawaii. Pat was on R&R, and you took Lynn out, 4 months old, and you spent a week together.
Yes.
And that must have been very strange, and good and sad and everything kind of in between. And here's Pat seeing his daughter for the first time. Can you tell me about your emotions of anticipation, and what did you expect to see in Pat? What, did you have like something, some forethought as to what you might expect from him emotionally, socially?
Well, I had heard from other people that he probably would have changed a little bit because he was under a lot of stress, of course. And we talked about him with the loud noises and everything and him waking
yes.
up and, you know, the floor
yes.
and all that. And and it was what I expected was true. I expected him to spend a lot of time with Lynn, which he did. I thought it would be more like a honeymoon type thing. Of course, it wasn't, because we had Lynn with us, and of course, she was going to be wherever we went.
And she's a little baby.
Yes. We did we did go out to dinner one time without her. And we found a babysitter type place that took the kids. And of course, it was, you know, a lot of people were there with their little kids at that time. I do have a couple of funny stories
okay.
to tell about
sure.
that. First of all, he wrote me and he said, I've talked to some guys that have been already there, mm-hmm. and he said there's no disposable diapers in Hawaii. And this was when Pampers were just starting
uh-huh.
to get, you know, and I used cloth diapers because, you know, my mom said they're better. And Pampers were really kind of rough, you know, at that, and so... So I had a whole suitcase of just Pampers.
Did you? That's an entire suitcase.
All I had was a whole suitcase full of Pampers and then a suitcase for her and I, of course. And, of course, I got there were Pampers in the stores. They were terribly expensive, but,
right.
you know. So, but we were prepared. And then when I got there, I don't know what I was thinking. It's just... I took a coat. This is June and July. I don't know what I was thinking. Yeah, be prepared.
Yeah.
Had all her stuff so she'd stay warm and everything. Of course, it's Hawaii, you know.
Sure.
And I live in California. You know, I know it's not, you know.
Right.
Anyway, so I get there, and there were about four or five women that had their babies that their their husbands hadn't seen on the flight.
Really?
And so we were talking and everything.
Were you all sitting near each other?
Yeah, because what they did was they put the most of us up front because there's room for the babies and all their stuff, and they used to have little, it was like a cardboard box that you could put your baby in, you know, to sleep and everything because they were too little to fit them.
Right.
They didn't have infant seats and all that stuff. Well, I did have an infant seat, but it wasn't, didn't have to be strapped down or anything. Anyway, so he told me what was going to happen when I got there, and of course, the routine where he was going to be there when I got off the plane, he wasn't. We all were expecting our guys to be right there, and they weren't. We had to get on a tram thing, a bus, and be gone over, and I said, he's never going to find me, never going to find me. No cell phone the back there, nothing.
Right.
They said, oh no, they're all going to be there when they get your bags, they'll be there. So we got there, nobody, they weren't there, but our bags were coming off, and so we're standing there with our babies and everything, and so this one girl and I said, I'll watch the babies, you'll get your bags, and then you watch the babies, and I'll go get my bags. So that's what we did.
Okay.
So she went and got her bags, and I came back, and then I went and got our bags. Mm-hmm. And by that time, Pat, and I didn't recognize him from the back, he was over there talking to the babies. Of course, he was talking to the wrong baby. And as I was walking up, he says, no, no, the other one over there. So that was kind of funny. Even though I had sent pictures and everything.
Sure. So. Did he look different to you physically?
Yeah, he looked very tired and strained. He did.
Okay. What was it like for the two of you seeing each other? This is after, what, 4 months? Or 6 months?
See, he left in October. November. Just, yeah, at the end of October.
So that's 7 months.
Yeah.
Okay.
It was, of course, we were really, really excited about seeing each other. And I was so happy to see him. I was just so happy to see him. I missed him a lot.
Yeah.
A lot. And,
did that surprise you that you missed him so much? Or?
No, I missed him even, well, you know, when I was at my mom's house. But I was more comfortable. I always had stuff around me, people around me. My sisters were still living at home. My grandmother was living at my mom's house also. So there was always activity, something to keep me busy.
Right.
We would always go do stuff, you know, and we went to church and things like that. And
sounds like you had a great support network.
I did. I really, really did. And but I missed him and having my own place. Which I didn't realize again till I went to Hawaii. He had rented a small apartment type thing. So we had a kitchen and all that stuff. So it was almost like having a little place again. And even the short time that we had been together, we hadn't even been together a year when he left.
Right.
And as a matter of fact, he missed our first wedding anniversary. Mm-hmm. And so, you know how you save the top of your cake?
Yes.
And you eat it a year later? So we had to save that for 2 years.
Well, you make do.
Yeah. So anyway, it brought home that, you know, we should be together and have our house and have our life. And it was kind of hard.
Yeah. Do you remember what you said to him when you saw him there on the airport?
Gosh, no. I just remember that we exposed each other so hard, you know, right about Lynn.
Poor Lynn.
Yeah, but I don't remember what they said. I really don't.
What was his reaction to Lynn? Do you remember?
He checked her over, like, to make sure she had all her fingers and toes and all that stuff, you know, and was afraid to hold her, just, you know, typical type thing and everything. Of course, I wanted him to hold her right away, but it was the mechanics of getting from the airport to the apartment and then deciding what to do and all that stuff. And,
right.
Yeah.
Was it almost surreal to kind of be in Hawaii and seeing your husband who's been off at war?
Yeah, because I had never been to Hawaii before. I'd never been to Hawaii, and I really didn't care where I was, actually. I had lived in Southern California with the beaches and everything, and it didn't really affect me. It was almost just like being down in Huntington Beach area to me. The only thing that I found
Huntington Beach, you said?
That's where my family lived, in that area there. actually Seal Beach was where my mom and dad lived. And so it was very close to the beach. We used to go to the beach all the time. So it wasn't, what I noticed was everything was really expensive. Of course, we had saved a lot of money. So we spent a lot of money that week.
He was able to send money home every month.
He did. As a matter of fact, he was really good. He played poker. And he won quite a bit of money.
Over in Vietnam?
Uh-huh.
No, he didn't tell me that.
Oh, he didn't. He actually did tell me. He says, and so he sent the money home and he won. He didn't. He kept a little bit, but he sent most of it home.
Okay.
And we had, I was able, like I said, to, we were pretty much, had no debt. Of course, he was a second lieutenant when he left. He had debts that he had to pay. That we were still trying to pay off when he first got into the Army as a lieutenant. And so I was able to get a lot of stuff paid off, the car, and all that. And so we had a real good fresh start when he got back. But while we were there, we spent a lot of money. We did see all the sights. We rented a car. Drove around the whole island in about an hour. It's real small. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's real small.
Did it surprise you?
Yes.
It was so small?
Yeah. I said, I don't think I could live here very long. It's very, to me, it was claustrophobic almost.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you think, in hindsight, that it was a good idea that you brought Lynn out there?
Oh, yes, definitely. Oh, yes. No. Yeah. If anything had ever happened to him, at least he had that.
Right.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Okay.
I was more worried about taking her for he and I to be together because that's what he wanted until he lost one of his friends, and then the whole picture changed. I think the big part was that we never did get a honeymoon. So that was, I thought, was going to be what it was going to be. And then, but we did have one when he came back. My mom kept laying in there. We took a ride up the coast.
Okay. So was there a sense of disappointment then?
No.
Okay.
No, whatsoever.
Okay.
I was more worried about him and what he wanted because this was really for him. I didn't really need the R&R. I just wanted to see him.
What did he do differently? Did he eat a lot of steak, or do things where things that he couldn't do in Vietnam? Did you notice things like that?
I think a lot of he wasn't a big fresh vegetable eater. He ate, I think, more like vegetables and things like that. I think they ate pretty good over there. I don't think, as far as he was concerned, he had a lot of, like back in World War II and stuff.
Right.
They've changed however they feed the troops anymore. I mean, they make it a little bit better. They found out that they perform better if they eat better.
Right.
So I don't think. We ate a lot of pineapple, fresh pineapple for breakfast, things like that. That was, I can't think of anything else. He's always been a steak and potatoes man, so it's not really, mm-hmm. was really anything really different.
Okay.
He had heard of a bunch of places to go and to see, and that's what we did.
Okay. How much did he talk to you about Vietnam?
Not a lot.
Did you ask him?
No. No, I didn't.
You just let him bring it up if you want.
Yes. I don't remember if he brought pictures, if this was then or after. At that time, I don't remember him talking a lot about it. He did talk a lot about the young man that did pass away.
Had he written about him in letters to you?
Yes. Yes.
Before he was killed?
No.
Okay.
It was after. It was after. I think, I don't know, that really hit him hard that he died. I didn't realize how bad until when we were stationed in D.C. and we went to the wall, and it hit him pretty hard.
So you talked about this gentleman in Hawaii.
Yeah, we talked about him and what he did. I don't remember if he told me how he died or anything. I don't remember that. Just that if anything ever happened to him, this is what he really wanted me to do, was to make sure I brought him. But basically, that's what I remember.
Did he tell you, or was there any conversation about, you know, if something happens to me in the next 5 months when I go back, here's what I want you to do?
Yes. Well, we took, of course, the practical side of it, you know. Mm-hmm. I was to go back to school. I could stay wherever I wanted. You know, I probably would have stayed in California and that. The money that I would be getting, I told you about the visit from the officer and the thing, and he was to be buried in Fort Sam. He wanted to be buried at Fort Sam.
These are things you talked about in Hawaii?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah.
But not before he left.
Mm-hmm. I don't think it hit either one of us when he first went over. He was, I hate to say excited, but we were both very young, and he wasn't alone in that. A lot of the young troops, and I saw that in the troops that we know now that are in Iraq, the ones that we know that are now majors and colonels, they couldn't wait to get over there. And they have families and stuff now too, and their families are older than Lynn and you know, ours was. It's what he was trained for, and his job was getting to being put to good use. And there was nothing that I could say to talk about that. I mean, nothing.
The excitement that you mentioned is very common. You know, mm-hmm.
Yes. And I was proud. I mean, I was proud. You know, my dad was in the military. He served. You know, and of course, we saw results of that. Of course, at that time, we didn't know that hardly anything was going to get done for all the work that everybody did over there. And so, I mean, he was doing a good thing. He was saving the world for democracy.
Mm-hmm.
That's
mm-hmm.
what we did.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about how Diana Curry was before Hawaii and how Diana Curry was after Hawaii. What changed for you as far as your personal outlook, your view of the war, your knowledge of the war, kind of the big picture?
Okay. For me, myself, I was pretty dependent before he left. After Hawaii, I realized that I would probably have to be more independent so that I was prepared if something did happen. I had a daughter that was dependent on me, and so I had to become very independent. And I did not want to have to be dependent on my family. As far as the war, my view after, I think I paid a little bit more attention to what was going on. More about what was going on in our government and what the president was doing or not doing, who was actually running the war. I did not understand, I couldn't tell, like, who's winning and who's losing type thing. I never really was aware of that. But I did know that from what Pat was telling me and from what I heard from other people was that the military was not running the war. The civilians were running the war. And that...
Pat told you this?
He told me that.
Okay.
And I heard that from other people that I knew that had come back.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what was hurting a lot of the military. And some of them got... not depressed, but discouraged.
Mm-hmm.
because they felt like they weren't really doing much over there, accomplishing what they were sent over there to do. And that was more towards the end, not really what I knew at the time.
Right.
That was more after he came back and we saw what was going on.
And this is, you were in Hawaii in 1969, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. How would you describe the two of you as a couple before and then the two of you as a couple after you saw him in Hawaii? Did anything change?
I think before, we were like just playing house, you know, I was doing the wifey thing and he was doing the husband type thing. And I think after Hawaii, it hit home that this was going to be a forever and more, not just having a house and doing the wifey thing and the husband thing. It was going to be a family, our own family. And it wasn't playing house anymore. It was really serious. And I think, this is my own personal opinion, is that young married couples don't get to that point for about 2 or 3 years. It's still the mechanics of trying to just get through life and everything and going to work, and now the wife works and everything. And I think it hit home for me a little bit sooner than it does for young married couples today. It could have been lost in a second, you know, and it didn't hit home till after.
Right. How was it leaving Hawaii? Was it difficult leaving
Hawaii? Oh, yeah. It was horrible. It was horrible.
Can you tell me about that?
I wanted him to come back with me.
Did you think about kidnapping him?
Okay. If I could have gotten him in my suitcase, you know. I was worried about him going back. Even just flying in, because I knew flying in was just as dangerous as just trying to get to where he was supposed to be. Because we heard about them getting shot in the helicopters all the time. And I don't remember if I had him call me through the Mars system or if he just, I can't remember what we did. But he wrote me as soon as he got there, you know, so I knew he got there.
But that still takes a week or more to get back to you.
But I don't know what, if he called me halfway. He had to stop. It wasn't a direct flight.
You go through Okinawa or
I can't remember.
Philippines, perhaps?
I think he called, I'm not sure, but I think he called me like halfway there.
Do you remember what you said to each other? You know, I'll see you in California? Or...
I don't remember. Of course, we said we loved each other.
Sure. Some couples...
Okay, we were going to meet in San Francisco when he got back.
You planned this?
Yes.
Okay.
And I was going to drive up there with my friend, and then she was going to fly back. So we'd have a car, and then we were going to have our honeymoon down the coast. And I'll tell you about that part later.
Okay.
But I don't really remember what we said, but we did say, well, see you like in San Francisco, whatever, our plans.
You made your plans.
Yeah.
Okay. I know some couples have said they had little catchphrases they would say to each other, you know, or they just simply did not say goodbye in some situations because they didn't want that to be the case.
No, I don't think we really said like a goodbye. We just, because we've been separated a lot, and we just, it's, you know, I'll call you when I get there, I'll see you, whatever. Even now, you know, he goes on trips and stuff like that. It's just something that I've gotten used to. Or I go somewhere, you know. So we're pretty independent and dependent at the same time. I don't know how to explain it, you know, do our thing. And like I said, the bad part when I was leaving was back here. I wasn't behind my head. I wasn't thinking about really what was going to, I just wanted to be with him. I wasn't going to think about what was going to happen.
Okay.
Except I was worried about him getting back in there. That was what I was worried about.
Right. Let me ask you this, and this is kind of a larger general question. How does a young couple deal with a war being inserted into their brand new marriage? I know you don't have much of a choice.
It was a true test, I guess. Like I said, I was really lucky. I was able to go back home to my mom and dad and my sisters, and they helped me a lot.
How did they help you?
A lot of it was with Lynn. I was a brand new mom. They, when I first got there, where it was only a three-bedroom house, and my grandmother had her room, and my mom and dad had their room. But when I got there, they moved out of their room and took a smaller bedroom, and my sisters and I slept in the one big room, their master bedroom. Because I was pregnant, and I needed to have, of course, they had a bathroom right there, and so it was very convenient for me. Then after Lynn was born, this is above and beyond. My mom and dad and my sisters all slept in the same room, and they gave me the small room to myself with Lynn.
Wow. That's incredible.
Yeah.
So just a ton of emotional and literal support for you.
And they both went to the hospital with me in the middle of the night to have her. And then when it was time to take care of her, if I wasn't nursing her or something, and if she cried, she got very spoiled very quickly because she had four moms, my two sisters,
right.
and my mom and me.
Right.
I mean, whatever she wanted, she got.
Is this the first grandchild?
First grandchild for both sides. Yes.
Wow. Have you told Lynn about this stuff? Have you told her these
stories? Oh, she knows, yeah, because I have pictures and everything, and so she knows. And we'll talk about when he got back at a later time. Mm-hmm. But she didn't know him. She was 10 months old when he came back, and she would not go to him. Mm-hmm. Took her a while to get used to him. So.
How did she react to him in Hawaii?
Of course, she was only 4 months old. She didn't, and she was used to people holding her all the time, so it was no big deal.
Okay. Well, I wanted to ask about some more things about Vietnam and what you experienced. Tell me about those Morris phone calls. How often was he able to get in touch with you that way?
Not real often. I think they kept them limited.
Mm-hmm.
But because I was pregnant and he was, the only way he was going to be notified was through the Red Cross. And it took them a couple of days to get to tell him after she was born, and we didn't know that till later. But I'm not going to get into the details, but I had a feeling that I was going to have her. She was 2 weeks late. So there was a 2 week, we had the due date, and then she was 2 weeks late, so there was 2 weeks that he was on pins and needles, just waiting and waiting and waiting to hear. And he wasn't hearing anything.
Right.
So he called one morning, and I had a feeling that she was going to be born that day.
Really?
But she was actually born the next morning, early. But I went into labor that afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't want to say anything, because it's my first baby, I didn't know. And so he called about 9 o'clock that morning. This was on the 25th of January. And my mom or my dad answered the phone or whatever. And they said, it's Pat, it's on the phone, it's on the phone. I said, okay, so I got the phone. And so you're talking and there's other people listening the whole time and you have to stay over when you're done. Well, he goes, Diane, I said, yeah. He goes, where is the baby? Over. I said, it's still with me. Over. And you hear this. I didn't want to tell him what I thought was happening. I had a sign that I might be having her.
Why didn't you want to tell him?
Because I didn't want to go on for, because it was going to go on for another week. So she was going to be induced probably the next week. And I didn't want him to get his hopes up and then not hear anything, So, I don't know. I didn't want to say anything. It was worry about that. So I just still told, still with me. Of course, we didn't know if it was going to be a boy or girl, you know, all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm.
Did you want a boy or girl? Do you remember?
I really didn't care. I think he wanted a boy. He had two brothers. I had two sisters. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I did. And I'm not used to boys. So I probably more leaned towards having a girl. So.
Okay. But when she was born, were you able to how did you tell him this? How did you get the information?
My mom, my dad, I think, had to go on a trip, so it had to have been my mom. We had all the information for the Red Cross. Called the Red Cross. I used to work for the Red Cross also, so mm-hmm. what they do is they call the hospital, verify the information, then they send a message. And then it's, I don't know how they did it back then, but we used to type it on a computer. And then it was sent to the servicemen, and they would get the message either by way of their commander or whatever.
Do you remember how he's recounted how he got
the message? I don't remember how he got the message. I just know it was a couple of days late.
Mm-hmm. Okay, when's the next time you were able to talk to him after that?
I don't know if we were able, I don't remember if we talked anymore after that or not. I really don't remember.
Until Hawaii.
Yeah. He sent flowers for Mother's Day. So that was me, yeah. He sent flowers, and I sent him pictures of me with the flowers and the baby in the backyard, you know, for Mother's Day and all that stuff. And I sent a lot of pictures,
You all were writing almost every day?
Every day, yeah.
How much did that help you? Was that a good reassurance for you just to sit and write him?
Yeah, it was. And, of course, my life was changing also because I had Lynn, and so it was something different pretty much every day mm-hmm. that was happening. So, and I really wanted him to be a part of that. That's the part that I didn't like him being gone. Mm-hmm. He missed a lot of that. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why he is the way he is with about the grandchildren. He was gone a lot when the kids were little, and I think that's why he's such a good grandpa now, is because he wants to be a part of all their mm-hmm. stuff that they do and everything. He missed a lot of birthdays and, you know, things like that. Right. So.
Okay. Wanted to ask you about what you saw on TV. Vietnam is the TV war, the first television war for the United States. What was that like for you to see that every day on the television and knowing your husband is in it? And how did that change your outlook on the war?
We watched the news every night. And they showed a lot of stuff. They really didn't show a lot of bad stuff like they do now. Like I said before Hawaii, it still didn't hit home. And I didn't realize that he was with an infantry unit. I still thought he was still in the ordnance.
Right.
Okay. So I didn't realize that he was on the ground actually running and fighting and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. It wasn't until after Hawaii that I realized exactly how bad it was and how dangerous it was. And that's when I really got scared in mm-hmm. this. When I was watching, my dad took me to see the Green Berets of all things. Of course, I believed it all. You know, when Dad got back, he said, it was not anything like that. He says, won't even tolerate talking about it.
Then he said that or now?
Well, back when he got back, you know, I told him when I'd seen the movie and everything, he says, I just don't believe any of this.
But so. did the TV, after you saw him in Hawaii, and you're still seeing, and you're realizing, okay, he's in danger. Every day, every night, his base could be attacked, his base
exactly.
could be rocketed or mortared every night. Did you watch less TV, more TV? Were you
interested? I watched it every day. I watched it every day. I wanted to know what's going on.
Do you think it was good for the country to have kind of this war on TV every night, reporting from the front? Because everything before this was censored. World War II.
Yeah, well, it was still censored. I don't think we got the true story. I don't think they could, at that time, they couldn't show us as much as we see now. A lot of it was not, they didn't show to me what I remember, is a lot of it was from the commentator, not really on the ground watching the troops do a lot of stuff. You know, I don't remember, all I remember is them showing the map and showing where our troops are, or where they were. They couldn't really show a whole lot. Talking about this happening here and this happening there. I don't remember a lot of seeing the troops doing things. Like you see now, you see all the going through the bushes and all
right.
that kind of stuff.
Firefights.
Yeah, I don't remember seeing a lot of that.
You mentioned earlier that you couldn't tell who was winning or losing the war.
Right.
And even watching TV and hearing the reports. And
I couldn't tell.
How about your parents? Or your sisters, for that matter.
My sisters were pretty indifferent. I don't think it really affected them except through me. You know, they were really worried about Pat, you
sure.
know, and everything. We did have, some, one of the guys that was in our little group that we had, he went to Vietnam, was back a month, and then he went to Korea.
You talking about your group in San Antonio or your
no,
group from
our,
in California?
In California, the surfer group that we had, that our friends that, you know, I went to school with for a while. And he came back and he had his hand blown, got hurt pretty bad.
In Korea or Vietnam?
I can't remember.
Okay.
So they sent him home and he wound up going right back to Korea. So he was back to back two places. And so that was, so there were people that we knew that were going over and getting hurt or whatever, coming back. And that's where my sisters knew them and everything. I don't remember how my dad felt. I really don't. And my mom was pretty much the same as I was. You know, just worried about Pat, and I don't know why I couldn't tell who was winning or losing. I don't know why. I don't think there was any winning or losing going on there at our time there. Towards the end in the early 70s, it kind of did turn the other way for them. But while we were there, it was just like hot spots going on here and there, and that's all I could remember. You know, put that fire over here, fire over there, whatever.
Right. Did you watch Walter Cronkite?
Yes, but I don't remember much.
But you remember seeing him?
Yes.
There. Okay. Was he considered kind of the trusted voice of
yes.
the news?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
But I still don't think we got the true picture.
What do you mean by that?
It's kind of the opposite of what we have now. It's all the bad stuff. I think they tried to put the best foot forward and showed most of the good stuff. We didn't. They did say some people were killed and all that stuff, but it wasn't all negative. We did hear some of the good stuff that was going on. So it's kind of backwards from what we're getting now. So
it's more of a balance. Than
yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
So I don't know why. I don't know.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned that, that you say that. It's something that's been said before that it was hard for the United States public watching from afar to see exactly what was going on. What they had was the news. They had government spokespeople, and they had military spokespeople, and that's all they had going on, and it was difficult to find out the truth. Now, this war was a very different kind of war for the United States. Did you notice this? Did you start to realize, or was this later that you thought more, you know, Vietnam's different, it's on TV,
Yes.
And it's not like World War II.
Now, like I said before, I think it was more or less what I thought, what I saw that was really different was the guerrilla warfare and the fighting. It wasn't like a whole, like a division or a battalion going in and taking a mountain or a hill or something.
Right.
It was to a small unit, not even a whole company, just like four or five guys
mm-hmm.
going in and taking a foxhole or, like I said, it was more guerrilla, more small units mm-hmm. going out and doing things. Because I had lived in Germany and France, I knew kind of, you know, the history of what was mm-hmm. going on and how the war was fought. And so this was, you couldn't see your enemy in Vietnam. You know, I mean, it was really hard to see them. They fought at night a lot, whereas during World War II and World War I, you could actually see your enemy. I know there were some night fights,
mm-hmm.
of course, going on, especially if you're done. And everything. But anyway, that's what was different.
Did you, is that hindsight, or did you kind of start to recognize that?
No, I knew that right up. When I got back from Vietnam, when I really started, not Vietnam, got from Hawaii,
mm-hmm.
That's when I really started to pay attention, and I knew, and a little bit of from what he told me, he loved the helicopters. They were their friend.
Mm-hmm.
What was the helicopter with? The Cobra?
Huey. The Huey or the Cobra?
The one with the guns.
The Cobra gunship?
The Cobra. That was their best friend. That was their lifeline. Getting supplies right away.
Mm-hmm.
Getting men in, getting men out.
Mm-hmm.
I remember him talking about that.
In Hawaii?
Yeah. See, some of the stuff I'm starting to remember.
Mm-hmm.
How scared he was the first time because there was no door, just a little strap thing, you know. So, yeah.
Did he talk about what war sounded like or smelled like, you know, gunfire, how loud rocket attacks could be, anything like that?
Yeah, I think that's, he does have some hearing loss because of the mortars, I guess they call them,
mm-hmm.
you know, the incoming
mm-hmm.
stuff. He said, you don't know how scared you can get until you can fit under your steel pot, which is your hat and helmet. That's about it, the
mm-hmm.
the sounds. He didn't talk too much. He didn't like to talk about the death part, which was fine with me. I didn't like to hear too much about that. He did tell me that the Viet Cong came that one time swarming over the concertina wire, and that was the only way they could stop them,
mm-hmm.
because they didn't have the, so they had to use the fire. Whatever that's called.
Do you remember him talking about the enemy? About, you know, Viet Cong, boy, they're tough, or boy, they're dumb, or what kind of comments did he make upon North Vietnamese or communists or an enemy in general? Do you remember any of that talk in Hawaii?
It was hard to tell sometimes who was your enemy and who wasn't. He said, you know, they'd come in and they would be spies, or they'd be the wash lady, or the little kid, or whatever. Just
mm-hmm.
like in some of the movies that
mm-hmm.
you see,
mm-hmm.
it was like that. Couldn't tell sometimes if they were your enemy or your friend.
Okay. As he's getting closer and closer to coming home, how are you preparing? What are you doing?
Well, I was getting my stuff ready to go on my trip.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember if we knew where we were going to be assigned or not. I'm trying to. That's always something you want to know, where you're going to go.
Sure.
And I think we knew we were going to go to Aberdeen Proving Ground, and that's in Maryland.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was preparing for that, and we were going to go to San Antonio first to visit with his parents, so we were making plans for that. I was preparing just for the trip, basic trip stuff. Like I said, when he got back and when we got settled, one of the problems that I did not foresee was the giving up of some of the control that I had. We did have some difficult times with that, and him wanting to take over the finances and things like that again. Not just the finances, but control of the household stuff. Because I hadn't had a house.
Right.
You know, so I wanted that. And he did too. Mm-hmm. So there was a conflict that mm-hmm. we had to get over. But we got over it. Right, we figured out who's going to do what and everything.
Right.
It took some time.
Right.
And we had to go back through the newly married stuff all over again, you know, because we had both changed a little bit. You know, I had grown up a lot, so had he. Yeah. And so there, we had a lot to deal with when he got back.
How hard was it being a female with a child, husband at war in America in the late 1960s? What was it like? How would you describe that?
Well, like I said, for me, it wasn't bad. I had support. I didn't have to worry about a job to help make ends meet. I didn't mm-hmm. have to worry about that. As a matter of fact, I did go back to school for a little while. Went back to school, took a couple of classes.
Working on your college degree?
Mm-hmm.
Is that there in Southern California?
Yes. I went to, it was called Central Texas at the Dodo Library. That was the first one. Cypress Junior College nearby. I've been to 7 different colleges.
Good for you.
Anyway, I've been all my life trying to get it done. But anyway, I was pretty independent. I had a car. I mean, I was pretty lucky. I really was. I didn't have to worry about too much, except mm-hmm. for him being gone and mm-hmm. making sure he was going to come back. I had food on the table, I had support. If I had by myself in an apartment, I probably would have gone stir crazy. I probably would have tried to get a job or something, you know, finish, you know, do something. I don't know. If I had to do that. But I it just never crossed my mind. It was always, I was going to go home if I ever had to go anywhere. So.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to talk to you about the transition when he came home and how you all worked that stuff out. Depending on your personality at the time, and then depending on what the man's experience or the woman, but mostly in this case, the man's experience in Vietnam, whether it's a heavy combat role or a support role, and their personality, all of those ingredients go together of how people get back together and go forward in the civilian United States out of a war zone, and the war still going on.
Yes.
And it's on TV every night.
Yes.
Before we talk about that, I do want to hear about, he comes home, and you know the date he's supposed to be there. You're going to meet him with your girlfriend. And tell me what happens.
He told you already. I know he told you.
He did tell me, yes. I have the benefit of knowing because I interviewed him. But I want to hear what you think about this.
We were having breakfast. It was, I think, a Saturday morning. Saturday or Sunday morning. I don't remember exactly because my dad was home. And Lynn was in the high chair. And she had breakfast all over.
Uh-huh.
And the doorbell rang. And my mom answered the door, and she said, "Oh, my God." I said, "Oh, my God, what?" You know. So I go running out there. And so I hugged him. I hugged him, and he hugged me really hard, and my mother was stuck between us, and she couldn't get out. And, of course, he comes in, you know, we're all talking and everything, and he goes and tries to pick up Lynn, and she just screams her head off.
She's like, "Who is this man?"
Yeah, just, of course, he's, I mean, very, you know, mm-hmm. just aggressive.
He was in uniform?
Yes. So he surprised us. So I'm thinking, there goes all of my plants. But it all worked out.
Right.
So,
what did you say to him? What are you doing here?
I know. Are we still going to go on our trip? I was just so happy to see him.
Yeah.
We were just so happy. So it was great.
What did you guys do that first week or so? Did you?
Well, he rested. He slept a lot. He wasn't sick at that time, but he did come back with some kind of a flu-like thing,
mm-hmm.
and which hits him every now and then.
Still
in his system, yeah. And not a lot, but other service people have said that they mm-hmm. came back with something and it was never diagnosed. They never could figure out what it was.
Mm-hmm.
It's not malaria or anything, but it's like malaria, something that comes back, and it's something like the flu that hits him about every 3 or 4 days, and then he's over it.
Wow.
But he slept a lot the first couple of days, and then we left Lynn and took our trip up. We came back. I think he had a whole month, so we had lots of time.
Mm-hmm.
And then we went and spent a week or two in San Antonio, and then we drove up to. And we had to buy a Mustang, we had to buy a roof rack for all the stuff. I was such a new mother. I had everything. We took the playpen. We had everything.
Right.
So I just probably took a whole lot that we really didn't need to take.
It's a huge move across country, and he's coming back from the war, and you're going to see his parents and family.
Yeah. And so he's going to, he was a first lieutenant when he came back, and then when he came back a year later he became second, a first lieutenant, and a year later he became a captain. So he was able to get a company when mm-hmm. he got up there.
Mm-hmm.
That's what was nice about the war, is they were promoted pretty much very quickly. Moved into government housing. We had to buy furniture. We had no, because the trailer we had everything in it. So the mechanics of just getting settled took about 3 or 4 months.
How did the government help you in this?
Well, we got housing. So, but as far as the furniture, of course, like I said, I had saved money, so we had the money to buy furniture and everything. They had a stove already in the refrigerator. We didn't have to worry about that. But we had to buy everything else. Now, because we still had the crib for Lynn. I don't remember. I don't think they give us furniture in the States. No, we didn't get furniture in the States.
Were the government officials, were they, when he was away, were they helpful to you at all? You said you didn't have much contact.
I didn't have that much contact, no. The only time I would see in the military is if I went to the doctor or anything like that. And get my ID card, I'd go to the commissary, PX, stuff like that.
Overall,
so I didn't need to see a chaplain or anything like that, because we had our own church that I went to. So as far as anything like that, I didn't really need it.
Overall, were they helpful in general before, during, after Vietnam, kind of transitioning? I mean, or was it just...
It was just us. We just thought that's the way it is.
Okay.
You know, the conflict we had when we got back was basically, I spent more time with Lynn than I probably should have, because I was alone now with my baby, and I didn't have all this help. So in order to get everything done that I didn't get done before, but everybody else helped with,
mm-hmm.
I did myself. Okay. So I was very focused on her and keeping the house
mm-hmm.
and doing all the stuff that I had done before.
Mm-hmm.
And before he wasn't in the picture.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't have to worry about catering to him and doing things for him.
Mm-hmm.
Or if he wanted to go do something, you know. So it was all of a sudden I had to get a babysitter. I had to do this and that and the other. And so that was kind of hard for... As a matter of fact, I had a neighbor across the hall that we used to trade babysitting because we were both real nervous about leaving our kids with anybody else. We were very, very overly protective of our kids, which I think was probably typical of that time because we were by ourselves for a while. And that was the basic conflict, was that. And plus, I had saved money, and we come back, and he comes back, and we're spending money. He wants to buy a new car. We want to, you know, buy all this furniture, and we're going back in debt again. And so I was upset about that. And I think it took us probably about 6 or 7 months to really get it together.
How'd you do it? Just talking, figuring it all out?
Crying, hollering, screaming. Finally said, you know, well, and he smoked a lot. He smoked a lot back then, and and of course my dad smoked, and I was kind of, you know, not really into it yet, and I wasn't used to it being in my house, you know, and I had my place that I could go, you know, and it was all over the house, and so I personally just made a decision, well, you know, I'm really glad he's back, and I'm not really happy with some things the way they are, but if I want to live with him, I'm going to have to accept some of the things that he does and just deal with it. And so that's basically been my philosophy for a long time.
Has it worked?
Has
it worked for you?
Yes. When I'm getting off the subject again.
It's fine.
But when we were in Germany the first time with our kids,
they were Pat.
They were 7 and 3, something like that. I can't remember. They would show on TV. We had these infomercials all the time over there. And we did have TV then, when we were there in the 70s. And they were really cracking down on smoking in the middle 70s. I mean, really. I mean, it was a fear factor, basically. And they showed a mom and two daughters standing over a grave of a military person who had died from smoking.
Wow.
That was the message.
Wow.
And the girls were really getting obnoxious about getting Pat to stop smoking. And understandably. Oh, Dad's going to die. And he was starting to get really mad at him. I mean, I bought him one of those ashtrays. I don't know if you remember, with where the thing spins around. Well, he would light a cigarette, stick it in there, and the girls would go whoosh, like that, and pop it out. I mean, brand new cigarette. And anyway, I finally sat him down, and I said, look, we both love Dad. We all love Dad. And, you know, if he gets sick from smoking cigarettes, at least we've had him for this amount of time, and he's happy. Let's not make him unhappy.
Right.
And they finally accepted that. They did. As young as they were, they did.
Okay.
And he finally did quit smoking. And I realized, too, shortcoming, that people that smoke or have an addiction, they're not going to quit unless they really want to. Yeah, I don't care what it is.
Yeah.
So, anyway, he finally did quit on his own in the 80s. So, anyway, but that's just another story about the military and how they kind of approach that smoking thing and how I dealt with it. If I want to have a relationship with this person, then I'm going to have to accept some of the idiosyncrasy.
Let's take a break for a moment.
Sure.
Okay, Diana, going forward, I wanted to ask you more of a personal question. All of these are personal questions, but about something you might not want to comment on.
Okay.
Feel free not to. About your spiritual existence and growth before he left, during the war, or during his year, and then after. Did you sense anything changing within you? For example, did you pray more, or did you become more distant? Could you have any comments on that?
my family was not really, really super religious. Mm-hmm. We went to church when it was convenient. I'm a Lutheran, and I went to, it was when I was in junior high and stuff like that, I had we went to Luther Lake. It was a good organization to belong to. And so I did a lot as a kid. Then when my dad retired, we joined a church in California. And he was a Presbyterian. He became Lutheran. Mm-hmm. And we would go to church every Sunday. But it wasn't anything really, you know, religious-like. Mm-hmm. While Pat was gone, I prayed every day. I prayed every day. I probably don't as much now as I did then. But I didn't think of it as being overly religious. Pat had a few problems with religion, and he was raised a Catholic, and I think some of that kind of put me off a little bit too. We've had some not so good experiences with the church. The first one being I was on birth control, and before we got married, Pat went and talked to a minister, a priest, and mm-hmm. he basically called us murderers because I was on the birth control pill. So that was his deal with that. So that kind of put a sour note in it. And then, of course, we joined the church. We got married in the church. And then we found out that our...
Married in the Lutheran church or Catholic?
The Lutheran church. Okay. He didn't want to have anything to do with it. Church.
He didn't, or you didn't?
He didn't. Okay. I was not, no. I, back then, from what I understand, is that if you marry a Catholic and you're religious about it, your kids have to be Catholic. And I wanted my kids to have a choice. Now, I baptized them in the Lutheran church, mm-hmm. but as a matter of fact, my youngest daughter now is a Baptist, so it's no big deal. As long as it's up to them. I'm
sure.
just not going to force them into any sure. super religion thing. Then we found out that our minister that married us was excommunicated. So, got kicked out of the church.
Wow.
I said, does that mean you're still married? So, we've had some sour notes
sure.
with the religion, and we tried going to the Lutheran church here, and we just started camping a lot and just kind of lost mm-hmm. touch with it all. So our church is nature and outside.
So during the war, you were daily
yes.
praying for God's safety?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
And
yeah, we did go to church.
Okay. Tell me about the anti-war movement and how that affected you.
Personally, it didn't really hurt me. Like I said, even during the war, we kept a low profile because we didn't want anybody to know that there was a military family member that was connected to our household. Okay, that
was
in California.
Can you explain that? Why?
Because of, and that's today. It's still today. The people are crank calls about
then,
your spouse.
Then?
Yes.
Okay.
I didn't get any. There were crank calls going around, people coming to the door and saying your spouse has been hurt or dead or whatever. Sometimes there were harassment phone calls going on about why are you over there killing, you know, women and children, and da 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 da. You know, don't you know what's going on? So that was going on. I personally did not have to deal with any of that. If I did, if anybody did call, I probably didn't hear about it because they wouldn't tell me.
So you were aware that this was a possibility?
Oh, absolutely.
So you did
we
not
were warned about it before they left. We were all warned.
The military
about it.
Did.
Yes, yes. And because of that, and that's, yeah, I was aware of it. And it's been that way up till actually Iraq, the first Iraq.
What do you mean it's been that way?
The military has always been pretty much the bad guy. Had to keep a low profile. During the first Iraq, we were stationed at Fort Hood. We were getting ready to retire. He might not have been able to retire. We didn't know whether he was going over mm-hmm. or not. And there were men posing as MPs that would go up to the women's houses, and they were raped and hurt. And when I worked for the Red Cross, I got a call from a mother who said that her son had called. She had a message on her machine that her son was at the airport in Austin, and that he had been hurt and he lost his arm and was waiting for her to pick him up.
This is during Vietnam or Desert Shield?
This is Desert Storm. So I'm saying these are the things that happen. And so she wanted to know if I could find out about it. I said, don't you go to the airport until I find out what's going on. Her son was Secret Service on a boat that didn't exist out in the ocean out there. And it took me a while, but I finally found him. He was fine, and he called his mom and said he was okay. So those are the things that go on. And people, that, you know, back then during Desert Storm, people put yellow ribbons on their trees.
Right.
You know, my husband is over there. But now it's totally different. You know, everybody has them on their cars and everything, mm-hmm. yellow ribbons. And so.
What about the Vietnam vets?
Vietnam, I just kept a low profile. I just did not let everybody know, you know, strangers or anything like that. We just, you know.
Don't you find that odd that America's fighting a war and you have servicemen and women doing their duty to serve their country, and yet you all can't?
It made me angry. I've always been a hawk at heart as far as going in and getting things taken care of. I've never been a dove as far as trying to get things taken care of. If they're going to fight, we're going to have to fight. Get them out of there. I mean, you just can't. It just because it goes on and on and on and on and on. Mm-hmm. And because of my military background, not me personally, but, you know, what I've seen and mm-hmm. what I know, it was awful. I couldn't understand why these people couldn't understand why we were over there and why these men and women did what they had to do. You know, some of them were over there. They were scared to death. They didn't want to be there. But they did go. We had some young kids that went off the deep end and wound up getting locked up because they didn't want to go. Young kids, well, they were our age, but mm-hmm. you know, they took a lot of drugs and did a lot of crazy things, and they mm-hmm. wound up in trouble because they were scared to death.
Did all this kind of having to keep a low profile come as a surprise to you all that, you know?
Yes.
You know, when he got into the military and your before Vietnam.
When he joined the military, it never dawned on me that this sort of thing would happen. I mean, it never dawned on me that we'd have to do anything like that. Of course, I didn't think he would have to go. I was hoping the war would be over and he wouldn't have to go. I was mm-hmm. just in denial, basically. You know, he's not going to have to go. And, of course, he was really worried about things, something happening to me or, you know, the family while mm-hmm. we were there. And of course, I mean, there was nothing like getting bombed or, you know, somebody messing with the car or stuff like that. I'm bouncing back and forth because when we were stationed in Germany, we that was bad over there. It was in the 70s and the 80s. It was bad.
What do you mean? What happened?
Well, we had to take a couple of terrorist-type classes to learn how to deal with the terrorism because it was starting to come into the housing areas.
So this was in the mid-1970s, I believe, after Aberdeen, then he went to Illinois?
Yes.
The Illinois National Guard?
Yeah. Well, yeah, he worked with the National
right.
Guard.
Yes. And then you all went over to Germany?
Yes.
Okay.
That was in
1977, okay. Mm-hmm. And so you all were warned and trained on how to deal with this?
Yes. Yes.
Is this a backlash toward America and Vietnam, do you think, or America in the world?
Well, Germany. I don't know what happened in Germany, but they started having these factions that didn't like the military.
Mm-hmm.
and they had, I'm not sure, I know some of the names, but I'm not going to say them because I'm not really sure. Even at Fort Sheridan, we had planned, the post had a Armed Forces Day celebration planned.
Right.
And we were picketed outside the gate. And so it was canceled. Just so, you know, nobody would get hurt. Ramstein was, then I'm going to all these different incidents where we were picketed mm-hmm. several times, just because we were military. I don't know, I really don't know why, you know, I don't, if they don't want us, didn't want us there. When we were at Fort Sheridan, the war was still going on, so we were still the bad guys. I don't know why. I don't know. I really don't understand it.
How does that make you feel?
It's hurtful. It's hurtful. Of course, you know, you try to explain to the kids, too. You know, they don't mm-hmm. understand it.
Right.
After we left Germany, there was a bombing in one of the housing areas. It blew out a bunch of windows in the government housing. No one was hurt, but it was a car bomb that went off. Mm-hmm. So it was very real there were several incidents as in the PX where they would have something happened. Someone would find something on like a briefcase or something, mm-hmm. and it would be left alone. And so we were stuck inside or outside of the mm-hmm. PX that we could leave. So those things were very, very real.
You mentioned in the early 70s, the war still going on in Vietnam, and you all had to really keep a low profile. Was that because of the anti-war movement? Was that because the war was unpopular in general, or the United States was quote-unquote losing the war? Why was that? And how did you do that? How do you keep a low profile?
Well, at Fort Sheridan, we really couldn't keep a low profile. In California, when I was living with my family, I could, because there was no military installation, mm-hmm. I mean, close to us, mm-hmm. or, you know, anything like that. We lived on Fort Sheridan. I worked at a bank, but most of the people in that area, in the Highwood area, were almost all military.
And this is in Illinois?
Yes, mm-hmm. yes, this is in Fort Sheridan. At Aberdeen, we lived on base. Well, we lived on base for both of them, so keeping a low profile was impossible. But you just didn't, you know, go downtown, like, to Chicago or take the train downtown and say, oh, yeah, my husband's a military, because you don't know who you're talking to, you know.
And he would not wear his uniform off base when he
No, he didn't have to. No, didn't have to. As a matter of fact, if they did, they had to wear it correctly, and that was one of the big problems that they had, was that they weren't wearing, the young guys weren't wearing their uniforms.
Right.
Oh, big pants.
What's that?
Big pants so bad.
Oh, they weren't dressed exactly.
Yeah, they wouldn't have their things back then. They had to have it tucked in the belt and all that, mm-hmm. and they would come out, you know, and have it all untucked, and mm-hmm. or half their boot undone, and mm-hmm. anyway, so. It made me feel bad that they felt that way. I don't know how to explain it. I don't mm-hmm. know why. Just something that I dealt with.
Did you think that the United States should leave Vietnam, you know, after Pat had come home and you know, we're going to 1970, 71, or?
I think we should have stayed.
Okay.
I think we should have stayed and finished it.
Did you think that then, or is that now?
I did then, and I still do. Because it was a waste of life,
mm-hmm.
a lot of lives. I don't feel like, this is my own personal opinion, I don't feel like we accomplished much over there. We got out too soon. The people, the Vietnamese and South Vietnamese were still suffering, you know, when we left. We mm-hmm. didn't do anything to help
mm-hmm.
that I could see.
We're out in early 1973. Do you remember where you were and how you felt April 1975 when Saigon fell and the country falls? And
I felt sick. We were at Fort Sheridan already, mm-hmm. and I felt sick. I just, all those people trying to get out, they didn't want to stay in their own country. I couldn't even imagine, you know, it's like we let them down. And that's why I am so glad that President Bush is making them stay to get it done. People just don't understand it. Like that woman sitting in front of there's a woman sitting in front of the White House. She was
in Crawford.
Yes, mm-hmm. Crawford. Wanting President Bush to explain some things to her, answer her questions. And what questions do you have? You know, your son died for his country, I'm sorry. You know, a lot of people did. But if we get out now, what's going to happen?
Mm-hmm. What kind of lessons do you think the United States learned from Vietnam?
And just what we're doing now. Stick it out. Get it done. What did we go in there for? Why did we go in there? Mm-hmm. I know a lot of it was financial. A lot of it was for money. Mm-hmm. There were American businesses and the French businesses were all there. And we wanted to keep hold of that. And
in Vietnam?
Yes. And Iraq is the same, I think. But the bottom line is the people, most of them, want us there. And that was proven during, I'm going back and forth, but, you know, the South Vietnamese needed us there because they were going to be overrun by the communists. Mm-hmm. Okay. And the Iraqis, when they voted, and then they want democracy. Mm-hmm. And I totally agree with what's going on. But that's me.
Do you think the United States learned lessons about how to treat veterans?
No. We were promised, we were promised full medical. That has been taken. I think they're good to the active duty soldiers. I'm hearing things, but I don't understand it. I saw something on the news about housing for troops when they come back. They're mm-hmm. living in slums and things like that. I don't understand where that's coming from. Mm-hmm. And I didn't see the whole story. So I'm not really sure. If that's because the service person got out of the military and is trying to find a job, so now he doesn't have a place to live, mm-hmm. or if, because the government housing, I mean, it's not all that great, but it's not slummy either. Mm-hmm. So I don't know where that's coming from, just something else for the news media to mess with. But, as far as a lot of the retirees are upset about that. We have to pay for insurance. Our the insurance we have given to us is very limited mm-hmm. and very structured.
Right.
And that's not what we were told. Pat is, I shouldn't say fortunate, but he makes a good retirement because he was in for the full 25 years. He also gets a disability, which helps him, which is not good. He's got a disability, but, you know.
Sure.
So that's part of it. I know that's why I see some of these old Vietnam guys and they're in wheelchairs and they're just, you see them in D.C. and, you know, and you just want to go, why are you like that? Are you just that screwed up over there? You know, I know some of them were, because mm-hmm. They were over there two or three times, you know. Mm-hmm. And that cast a play on you, you know. But I know that there's help there. The veterans' hospitals are always there for these vets.
Right.
Whether it's the help they really think they should get or whatever, but I know they're there because I worked with the Red Cross and I know that we worked with the Veterans Hospitals and I worked with some crazy vets. So I know that the help is there.
Right. Tell me about your experience at the Vietnam Wall and Washington, the memorial?
Well, we were there when it was going up, when it was built, and then I don't remember how long it took us to go see it. Wait a minute, maybe it was already built when we got there. It's hard because we were in Virginia, and then we were still in Virginia, but we were at Fort Lee, and then,
right.
So we were still pretty close to D.C. at that time. That it was kind of neat. My mom was living with us at the time, and we all went, and Pat, they had a book that you could look at to find the name, and that's basically why what we did was we went to. And it wasn't emotional enough for me, but watching Pat, I knew he was going back and remembering some of the things that happened.
What did you witness with him?
He started crying. When he found the name. I asked him, do you want to leave some flowers or something like that? And so, I think he would like to try to find his wife and his son and talk to him.
Yeah.
That's my own personal opinion. I've never really talked to him about it, but I think he would like to do that.
Mm-hmm.
It's very impressive. Of course, we've seen the one when they bring it here a couple of times. I've walked by that one.
You like the memorial?
Oh, yeah. And we saw the one to the... Was it the nurses?
Mm-hmm.
The,
yes.
We saw that one here when it was... Before it got shipped out.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very impressive. Do
you and Pat talk about Vietnam today?
No.
Why not?
I don't know. I know he had some heart stuff that he had to deal with. And, like I said, unless he wants to talk about it, I don't bring a lot up. And he said, as a matter of fact, before I came, he said, I didn't tell you much about Vietnam. And I said, no, but you did tell me some things. And so I told him, did I tell you that? I said, yeah, you told me that.
Mm-hmm.
So he doesn't even remember some of the things he told me. When he brought back pictures, pictures of little kids and little puppy dogs and some of the people that were there, and this is the lady that washed clothes and did this and all that, you know, but none of the, he says, a lot of the guys took pictures of the dead bodies and all that kind of stuff. He said, but I couldn't do that. And I said, well, I'm going to die. You didn't do that. You know, I don't understand it, but, you know, I guess it's their trophy or whatever. I don't know. But I don't think he really even brought anything back as far as a helmet or a sword or anything like that. So,
how do you think Vietnam has most affected your life?
Today, I don't think it. It made me a little bit more independent sooner than I thought I'd have to be.
It's a good thing or bad thing?
I think it's good. It helped me get through, being more independent helped me get through when he would have to go to, like when we were stationed somewhere, he had to go before me.
Right.
So I had to deal with all the other stuff by myself. So it made me more capable of handling things and knowing where to go for things and doing stuff. And, when we were at Fort Sheridan, he was gone a lot. And I worked full time and had the kids going to school, and I did all that like a single mother. So he was gone quite a bit. So I think in that respect, it did help. And I think he kind of resented it at first, but now I think he's glad of it. Especially now that we're getting ready to retire, I drive the motorhome. We go off-road now and do all kinds of stuff that, you know, a lot of the guys, they go, how do you get your wife to come out here to do this? She's like, it was her idea. You know. So,
it's not me, it's her.
Yeah, so, you know, it gave me the drive to finish my education and get my teacher's certificate.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's that. As far as Pat's side, it's more of a quiet side for him. I don't really that's the part that I'm afraid to open the door because there might be stuff in there I don't want to know. That's just my personal opinion.
So you let it go?
Yeah.
Do you think you guys will ever talk about it?
I don't know.
Do you want to?
I would like to know, yes. Yeah, I would like to know. But I don't want to force him. I don't know if I want to hear the bad stuff. Because I don't want to make him feel bad. If he did anything over there that, as far as, I don't know, you want to say killing people or whatever, mm-hmm. he feels like guilty about mm-hmm. any of that. I don't want to dredge all that up. But if he's got to get it out, then he's got to get it out. If he's hanging on to it, I have no clue. I mean, I don't notice anything different. He's always had a bad temper, so I never really. I mean, I wouldn't tie anything into mm-hmm. that. He's gotten a lot better as far as his temper goes, but I don't tie anything in his personality to because of it.
Okay.
It was a rough time in our life. It probably would have been scarier had I been older and known more what's going on. I think because I was so young and a little bit ignorant about mm-hmm. things. And right. life was so new and fresh.
Right.
And I got through it, you know, mm-hmm. just kind of, you know, like a dumb blonde, you know, just get through it, you know. Other than that.
What would you say to a military wife today whose husbands are off, partners are off in war?
Handcuffed. Be positive that they're going to come back. Don't think of the negative. Take care of business at home because they're going to come back and he's going to want his home. Mm-hmm. Or she's going to want her home. Make sure you show the kids pictures. And now you can talk to them on the phone, talk to them on the computer. Mm-hmm. Do it all. That we didn't have that advantage. Have the kids get on the computer and type. You can send them pictures on the computer. Mm-hmm. It's great. It's just great. Mm-hmm. Send lots of pictures. Lots of pictures.
Okay. Is there anything else personally from your story, your experiences, that you want to talk about or bring up?
I can't think of anything else right now.
Okay. How has this interview experience been for you, talking about your experience during the Vietnam War and what you went through before, during, and after, and even up to today, your viewpoints today? How has this been?
With the interview, I don't think I really thought about what I did or what I didn't do. It was just something, I just got through it.
Mm-hmm.
I never really thought about how I felt mm-hmm. until how I really felt about things.
Because mm-hmm.
It all kind of jumbles together, what's happening today. I probably would have felt the same back then as I do now if I hadn't been so ignorant about things, you know.
Right.
I've seen a lot, so I have opinions now that I didn't have before. I did travel when I was a kid. I did see it. So I probably would have had the same feelings about war and the military in general as I do now, just mm-hmm. because of my background when I was young. Mm-hmm. I know what the military does. I do know another life now, but I don't think I would be the person I am without all the traveling that I did and all the being without my husband, being around and mm-hmm. having to take care of things.
Mm-hmm.
I think about my sisters and their husbands are not in the military, but they still have that
they have to travel, they still have to move around, they don't travel, but they're doing something a lot, always on the weekends or whatever, they mm-hmm. have to be busy. They love to travel, though, they really do. Mm-hmm. My one sister is married to a Swiss guy, and they go to Switzerland every now and then, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's still, I think, in our blood, and I was fortunate to be able to just travel more than I did. Mm-hmm. I lived in Europe for 12 years of my life.
Right.
So it's a big part of my life.
Right. Okay. Well, this will end the oral history interview with Diana Curry. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.